We will be dealing with the Finance and Fiscal Commission regarding their submissions, the presentation, the briefing, etc. For this, let's put ourselves off or on silent. Mine is off. Apologies for that. I was notified yesterday that the Standing Committee on Appropriation in the NA will also be joining us, but I don't know at what stage of the day or what time. So we are carrying on with our meeting. They are welcome to join us. I believe there are other committee meetings as well running. We received an apology from Honorable Monsisi, a written apology that he won't be able to attend this meeting due to family responsibilities. The other apology I will read when we deal with the Department of Sports and Recreation. Honourable members, you received documentation regarding today's briefing by the FFC, and you should also have received this book. It's got lots and lots of information in it. Actually, it's an excellent research document on what's going on. Did you all receive this? Secretary, please take note who didn't receive this. It was handed out, if I'm correctly, the day we had our meeting where we discussed our strat plan, etc. That's quite a while ago. It was in the beginning of June, if I'm correct.
Sir, Honourable Chair, was it that day when we received that bundle of stuff?
Yeah, some of us had to get a trolley to take it away, but but the Secretary is taking notes, Zolani, Mr. Rito is taking notes, and that you get this document, because you must have it. The other documents were in your pigeonholes. And I'm going to ask the members to please introduce themselves. It's our first session, our first meeting with the FSC, that they also get to know us. I was fortunate to have a one-on-one session with Dr. Satai quite a while ago in May. Thank you for the time you made available that we could discuss a few matters. My name is Charles de Beer. I'm a chairperson of the Select Committee. I'm representing the Northern Cape in the NCLP, and I'm a member of the African National Congress. We can go down on my left-hand side, the members. Honourable Mokgoro.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Counselor.
My name is Gauta Mokgoro. I'm a member of the Finance Committee, delegate of the NCOP. I am from the Northern Cape and representing the spirit and desire of the Northern Cape. Thank you.
Honorable members, also Petra.
Yes, my name is Lenias Mashile, a member of the Select Committee on Finance and Appropriations. I'm a member of the African National Congress, coming from Mpumalanga.
Tim Harris from the Western Cape and the Democratic Alliance.
Mazaban, what
Well, you can see to what they are capable of. That's a good introduction.
Yeah.
On my right-hand side, honorable members. Down there.
Mukangeli Matomela, Eastern Cape, ANC, chairperson of the Finance Committee.
Born in the Eastern Cape. Anyone on this side?
My name is Tani Bunda. I'm from the Northern Cape. I'm also a member of the Select Committee of Finance, and I'm also a member of the Independent Democrats.
Harold Nguni, member of the committee, ANC Free State.
Dr. Santai, I'm giving you the opportunity to introduce your team.
Dr. Chair, can they just put on their mics so that it can be recorded? Thank you.
Okay, since it's quick, yeah, my name is Bethwell Sitai, the chair of the FFC. Thank you. David Savage, a national appointee to the commission.
Debo Makube, program manager, fiscal policy at the FFC.
Eddie Rakabe, a researcher at FFC.
Sabelo Mtandato, a researcher at FFC.
Thank you for the introduction. Honorable members, the program will go on as is. We will first get a briefing from the FFC, the inputs, take your questions, etc. There is enough time for that. We are here until we finish today's work. After that, we will call in the departments to come and do their submissions. The departments who responded were Sports and Recreation, as well as Department of Transport. Now, Human Settlements is supposed to be here as well, but we haven't heard anything from them, so we see what's going to pop up through the day. Section 220 and 221 in the Constitution outlines the composition of the FFC. So when you deal with the documentation of the FFC, you must have the Constitution next to you, because that gives the direction. What are they supposed to do? And then also in section 214, the equitable share and allocations of revenue. That is a specific sections in the Constitution that is important for us. Honourable members, without further deliberation, I'm going to ask the chairperson, Dr. Sitai, to proceed with the presentation. Welcome again.
Yeah, let me thank the chairperson for having introduced the mandate that we get from the Constitution. I will just add a small piece. This piece will say that for us to actually come as far as we are today, we will have interacted with various stakeholders in the intergovernmental fiscal relations environment. And we are also part of the budget system, the national budget process, where we have regular meetings with the Budget Council, the Budget Forum, and various technical committees. We are required by law to submit our recommendations 10 months prior to the tabling of the budget in Parliament. And when we table our recommendations, that is what starts the budget process. Also not indicated there in terms of our computer projection is the structure of our submission. Our submission contains 8 sections. The first section reviews the provincial equitable share formula. The second part is the public infrastructure investment. And then the third part is the efficiency and equity effects of social grants. The fourth part is the performance of public hospitals. The fifth is rental housing. The sixth is management and financing of road infrastructure. The seventh is assessment of universal access to water and sanitation services. And finally, the assessment of the institutional and fiscal capacity support mechanisms of local government. Then section One, actually, I'll go to the recommendations, the principles right here. Okay. We are saying in our principles that there is still a need to clarify expenditure assignments between provinces and national government, especially distinguishing between delegated and own responsibilities. That is matter of principle, that is clarifying expenditure assignment. And secondly, we say there is still need to introduce clear separation of instruments in the transfer system and the provincial equitable share. Thirdly, we need to provide more revenue autonomy for provinces and also incentivize them to utilize existing revenue sources. And then we need to encourage provinces to have the ability to borrow or use what the Constitution says they can do to borrow. Then in the short term, we are saying that we need to refine the provincial equitable share formula to retain most parts of the current structure with the following additions, that basically the formula should not only include what it the structure it has now, but it should be closer to an equitable equalization grant. Yeah, I think that is the main thing we are recommending. In the medium term, we also say that efforts to reform the provincial equitable share should acknowledge that other aspects of the current intergovernmental fiscal relations also require amendments. For example, separation of education and health from the provincial equitable share, conversion of these components into separate block grants, and then introduction of the equalization grant. We recognize that this may actually require amendments to the Constitution. So basically, that will conclude my highlights. And then I will pass on to our researchers, Eddie Rakabe, maybe we could do public infrastructure and efficiency and equity. Sir. Over to you.
Okay, the second chapter deals mainly with public infrastructure, and the underlying motivation why we...
Excuse me, can you please just speak into the mic? Thank you.
Okay. The underlying reason why we issued this chapter was because of the macro, the present macroeconomic challenges.
Okay. The present macroeconomic, challenges... and the lack of sufficient economic growth required to reduce the significant level of unemployment and poverty. We recognized in our studies that major investments to expand existing infrastructure is necessary to address the imbalances, the backlogs, and also support developmental efforts. And compounding the problem of infrastructure in our country is that there is also problems of maintenance spending, which is below where it should be. We have run some simulations in our study. We modeled and simulated a 10% increase in the baseline for water, health, electricity, roads, transport, and communications. Those are basically your basic infrastructure. And the recommendation that followed that we made out of this chapter is that we need to increase both departmental baselines in the quantum of appropriate investment in public infrastructure linked to basic services. And for the funds that are already in the system, we are recommending that there should be improvement in the quality of targeted outcomes on infrastructure investment. And we also recommend that there must be adoption of a comprehensive infrastructure maintenance strategy specific to the sectors with high impact on unemployment and poverty. And lastly, we recommend that there must be a cooperation in intergovernmental, the cooperation with regard to planning and spending, especially at local and provincial spheres, should be strengthened. The third chapter dealing with social grants in South Africa, we noted in our studies that social grants in South Africa, social assistance system in South Africa, especially with regard to the grants, they are well targeted and significantly reduces poverty. With regard to poverty, we know that there is a reduction in both individual and household poverty over a sustained period. But with regard to the labor market, we know that access to old age, disability and child support grants discourages labor market participation by economically active dependents. It tends to tie work seekers to rural areas where opportunities are scant, and it also creates dependency and may resultantly pull the entire household into a poverty trap. Some grant recipients such as their HIV, AIDS sufferers forgo, sometimes they forgo, they will anecdotal evidence that they forgo treatment to get the grant, and other anecdotal evidence is that the grants sometimes have an impact on an adverse impact on teenage fertility. To this effect, we make the recommendation that government should increase the rollout of social grants to cushion the vulnerable people from the effects of economic downturn. But it must also manage the risk and opportunities associated with the scaling up of social grants. We also recommending that social assistance should be managed in such a way as to eventually reduce dependency on social grants. Obviously, we recommend that efforts to promote economic development should be strengthened. And lastly, we propose that government should use infrastructure expansion to provide opportunities for workfare programs, as well as activities identified in the public works program. And in this instance, we are proposing that EPWP projects should be used as a pilot for workfare immediately. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. And Teboho.
Thanks, Chair. Chapter 4 is on the components of public hospitals. The Commission has noted that, there's an enabling legislation, both in terms of the Constitution and the quite number of health legislation that enables the access to health care, but we know that there is some bottlenecks that still hamper the realization of these rights and practice. And also, there are other institutional factors that hamper this access to health services in regards to coordination and integration of systems. And also, we know that there is no specific national hospitals policy or act guiding the operations of these institutions. From an operations perspective, the Constitution knows that the issues of functions and responsibilities with regard to hospitals is not clear between the hospitals themselves and the health departments. And evidence suggests that reforms aimed at granting hospitals that the devolution of certain functions to hospital management might foster efficiency, and it's something that we need to, in a way, consider as a country. The other point that the Commission notes is the lack of standard performance to determine the structure of budgets, because there's no a particular format that allows provincial departments to determine budget allocations per hospital. So we know that it depends on the discretion of provinces to allow or to allocate budgets per hospital. And we are noting that this hampers the operation of hospitals. In this regard, we made the recommendations that there be a legislative provision and norms and standards to ensure a well-functioning public hospital, and that we institutionalize budget formats and processes for public hospitals. Thanks.
Thanks very much. David? Oh, Sabelo, I'm sorry, done that. Rental housing?
Okay, thanks, Chair. Rental housing, yeah, we're all aware that access to housing is one of the basic constitutional rights in South Africa. And then practically there are two ways in which this can be fulfilled. It's either you provide your RDP to a low income earners or on rental opportunities. And then, but internationally, a general consensus is that a well-functioning housing system is one that has the balance between the two. Whereas in South Africa, there's been a lack of rental opportunities, which is why we undertook this. Okay, the next slide, please. Okay, looking at this, this graph illustrates the demand for rental housing. If you look at the green area, that part represents the number of shacks in South Africa that have been increasing over the years from 2002 to 2006. And then again, under that one is a rooms in the backyard, and you can see that both that green and in the part which is a sky blue color, they're increasing. That illustrates that there has been an increase in the demand for rental housing in South Africa, whereas on the other side, the supply side hasn't been supplying enough rental opportunities for those low income earners. I identified.
Please hold.
Yeah, Chair, I just want to make sure that I'm following. I just want to check whether I've got the same understanding of the word rental housing. If they could just explain to me what rental housing means, so that I've got the same understanding when it moves forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Your explanation?
Yes. Okay, rental housing is a form of housing where a tenant who's occupying that unit pays rent. Then it could be provided by the social housing institutions. And then, or also could be in the form of your former hostels that have been upgraded to be family units. That is rental housing. So the tenant who occupies that kind of unit for sure should be a person who earns some income so that you'll be able to pay some rent. It's unlike RPP, which is like a free to the tenant. Okay. So we have identified a number of factors that are hampering the development of rental housing in South Africa. The first one relates.
Excuse me. Yes?
My apologies. I need to just go back to the previous slide, if I may, because I do not understand what the figures are. There are figures in each of the blocks of color. What are those figures? Are they tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands? What is the significance of those figures, please?
Okay. Those are thousands. But for the analysis right now, probably for just to understand this, I just put them there so that you can just see the number that it has been increasing. But you can even ignore the number and look at the shares in which these kind of dwellings have been increasing. So you can see they are widening towards the end, the informal ones, which are sheds and the backyard houses.
Are there any more questions? With regard to page 17, the slides we've got on the screen. I want to welcome also the members of Treasury here,
You must please introduce yourselves. There's some new faces. But also I want to welcome the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Appropriation in the National Assembly, Honorable Sigourney. Previously, he was also a member of this committee in the NCLP, now deployed in the National Assembly. Welcome, Honorable Sigourney. Treasury, please, before we go further, please introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Wendy Connor from National Treasury. I'm working in the Intergovernmental Relations Unit, amongst others responsible for preparing the response, the national government's response on the FFT recommendations.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Winston Peterson. I'm the Office of the Minister of Finance in Parliament. So I'm doing parliamentary liaison. Thank
you. All our meetings until Friday. So welcome. Please proceed. Sorry for the interruption, but now we know who's here.
Okay, thanks very much. On the slide, we have highlighted a number of factors that we found that they are hampering the delivery of rental housing in South Africa. The first one is the what is called the designated restructuring zones. There are some zones here that have been identified where the social housing project should be undertaken within those zones. And then if a project falls outside those zones, then it doesn't benefit from the social housing capital structuring grant. And then we've seen that as one of the factors that is hampering the rental housing sector. Secondly, it's lack of coordinated approach by sector in the provision of housing. Thirdly, is the cumbersome requirements to qualify for a social housing capital structuring grant. Here, one of examples is that for one project to qualify, even if it's within the identified zones, for it to qualify for the social housing capital structuring grant, it has the unit should be at the size of 42 square meters. So while this is a good for new projects, but these social housing institutions, in some instances, they buy buildings that already exist, and then it's very difficult for them to increase the sizes. Then we're saying this is also the factor that is hampering the rental housing. Okay, slow disbursement of fund is one of the factors, and then the income band that has not kept up with inflation. Okay, from those factors, and then we came up with some recommendations. The first one relates to the eligibility criteria for accessing social housing capital housing grant, that it should be flexible and it should allow projects that are falling outside these zones to access the funding. Secondly, the number of these zones, we feel that they need to be it needs to be expanded so as to respond to the demand for rental housing. And then the requirements for the minimum size unit for redevelopment of existing buildings, again, it should be revisited. The process of disbursing funds for rental housing should be made shorter to minimize time lag following submission of approved project plans. Okay, we also recommend that the Social Housing Regulatory Authority should improve intersectoral coordination between various government departments that are responsible for integrated human settlement. And then lastly, that the qualifying income band should be reviewed and adjusted to ensure that people are not who should benefit and are not excluded from benefiting from the subsidy. Thanks.
Thanks. Chapter 6 is on roads infrastructure. The commission here it's making an analysis on four components. One is about the road network in the country. Two is about the funding model for road infrastructure. Three is around the institutional framework for road development, and four is about the human resource challenges in the sector, especially technical skills. With regards to the road network, we have done some benchmark analysis internationally, and we have noted that institutions in the country, your Center for Scientific and Industrial Research and your engineering institutions have come up with studies that knows that about roads in the country are deteriorating, and 60% of national and provincial roads, as well as local authorities in certain instances, are poor as compared to 10%, which is the international benchmark. And in that regard, then, the Commission makes certain recommendations in the study that we need to increase the funding for construction, maintenance, and rehabilitation of roads. And if you look at Chapter 2 on public infrastructure, where we said we have run some simulation, roads is included, there is a need to increase funding for that. And we are saying that there's a need for the country to review the way provincial and local government roads are funded as compared to the funding for national, which SANRAL is mandated to do. So if you look at SANRAL, you'll see that they can borrow in the market, there's a national transfer, and they can also raise funding through tariffs or toll roads and so forth. And we are saying that where there is an economic feasibility, we need to review that and expand the user charges, and that we review the equitable share, so that we also, you know, have a considered attention on roads funding, and that there is a role for development institutions to play a role in assisting the government to increase infrastructure investment in the road sector. From an institutional point of view, then we are saying that there's a need for a greater coordination, that the roads coordinating body can play a significant role in assisting provincial and local government to deliver on their mandate, making sure that roads are well maintained. And we are saying that this structure needs to be looked at. And also, I mean, the issue of technical skills in the sector is one of the reasons that is hampering the delivery of roads to reduce transaction costs in the economy, and that's an area that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to deal with the final two chapters in the recommendations that are specifically looking at issues of water and sanitation and the capacity of local governments. On the water and sanitation side, this is an issue that I think members will be aware that there's been quite a lot of attention placed recently on the reliability and quality of water supply, particularly by municipalities. I think following on from the electricity crisis, there'd been a concern that perhaps we were headed for a water crisis. I think that in general, the Commission in its work didn't find that the crisis was at all of the same, the prospect for a crisis was at all of the same nature as the electricity crisis, the industries being quite different. But nonetheless, there were significant challenges that needed to be faced in the water services sector going forward. The key focus of government's strategy in the sector has been to try and secure universal access to services. You know, quite rightly so, given that these are very, very basic services. As the Department of Water says, Water Affairs says, water is life, sanitation is dignity. But yet, when we look across the effectiveness of policy implementation, we see there's an emerging gap between policies, very well-meaning, quite high-flying policies in a way, and the capacity of government in various spheres to actually implement those policies. One of the most obvious places where this gap has emerged has been in terms of setting targets for achieving universal access to service, and I'll dwell on that a little bit later. One of the big challenges that has been very well exposed by the engineering profession is a lack of qualified staff in the water services sector to manage capital assets for the treatment and distribution of water and the collection and treatment and discharge of sewerage. And related to that, insufficient investment in those water services assets. Other issues that were identified in our scan of the environment was that it remains a significant problem in the ability of people to pay for services. This is particularly acute when it comes to sanitation services, waterborne sanitation services, which are very high capital costs for the installation of infrastructure, but as well as operating costs. The monthly operating cost of a waterborne sanitation network is pretty high. I think it averages around 70 rand per household per month. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but somewhere in that ballpark figure. And many people are unable to pay for that. And in the case of water, unable to pay for an amount of water over the stipulated 6 kiloliters per household per month. And finally, so that creates a financing challenge for the sector in terms of trying to expand services to everyone, yet still needing to cover the operating costs for the ongoing provision of those services. And finally, that in the way in which prices are set, typically by municipalities, but not only by municipalities in the sector, they need to make a range of trade-offs between the recovery of capital costs, the cost of installing pipes or water treatment plants, and the operating costs, the daily costs associated with staff or chemicals or fuel. They need to make sure that their pricing for water covers both of those issues. They need to make sure that there's a balance between recovering costs for services and subsidizing to make sure that all South Africans have access to at least a basic level of service on an ongoing basis. And thirdly, to make trade-offs between the need to invest to support economic growth, because water is critical to almost every economic activity in the country, to make sure that expenditures are fairly distributed so that the targets of universal access are met, and to make sure that the environment is protected. Water and sanitation both have critical environmental impacts. I think that those are difficult sets of trade-offs to make. And in our review, I think what we found was that there's currently no mechanism. It's not that those trade-offs aren't being made, typically at a municipal level, in some form consciously or less consciously, but that there's no coherent framework of oversight of how these trade-offs are being made, with the implication that there may be a longer-term fiscal liability that's being generated for national government should a municipality make an inappropriate set of trade-offs that leads to the collapse of services at some later point in time. When we look at, I wanted to dwell particularly on this gap between policy intentions and the actual outcomes, and look at this question of policy targets that have been set in the sector. Now, there was a policy target that by 2008, all people would have access to safe drinking water. And when we look at the survey data from the 2001 census, which is the 2001 census is the one data set, and the results of the 2007 community survey, both official Statistics South Africa data sets, we can see that there has been significant improvement in access to water, but that this this is variable across provinces, and the it is not universal access by 2008 by any manner of means. So that's essentially a policy target missed. It's just to unpack the graph that you're looking at on the screen a little bit more. The provinces, each of those two bars represents the position of a province in terms of percentage of households with access to piped water. With the first bar for each province representing the 2001 census result, and the second bar representing the 2007 community survey results. The blue bars on the right-hand side are the national averages. So you can see overall there's been an improvement nationally, and all the other ones, as I said, were the provinces, individual provinces. What you can see there is that the Eastern Cape, which is the first bar in green and red, KwaZulu-Natal and Limpopo are well below the national average in terms of households with access to piped water. If we go to the next slide, we have a similar chart which looks specifically at access to sanitation. What this shows is households with access to a flush toilet, which is well above a basic level of service, which is regarded as a ventilated improved pit latrine. But we can see that levels of access in sanitation to sanitation services was significantly lower than in the water sector. There was a target that that all South Africans would have access to basic sanitation by 2010. As you can see, that little under 60% have access, according to the community survey data. There have been probably more significant improvements than in the water sector, but off a far lower base in terms of the percentage of households that have access. So I think basically what these two slides point out is that you have policy targets of 2008 and 2010, which are for universal access, and that clearly is a desirable goal. But the reality is that the implementation has been quite far from being able to meet those targets. And I think it does call for some reflection on the process of how targets are set and who owns those targets in terms of their performance. Just very briefly, in terms of the recommendations based on our review of the sector, is that I think that there's a call for a review of the basic water and sanitation strategy, specifically focusing on the current free basic water and sanitation subsidy policy. I think there's a concern that is pointed out and discussed in some detail in the recommendations that the current system of subsidizing access to basic services, the operating costs of basic services, have costs that go with them, not just the financial costs, but costs in terms of the leakage of subsidies to non-poor households and the exclusion of some poor households from receiving the subsidy. And one needs to make sure that the subsidy strategies that are adopted by municipalities reduce this leakage. These are called in the economics literature errors of inclusion and exclusion. An error of inclusion is when somebody who you're not really targeting to get the subsidy, all of us, for example, all non-poor people, actually end up getting the subsidy. But those who are poor don't get the subsidy at all. How would that work in practice? In urban areas, municipalities have adopted a rising block tariff structure. Now, if a single fairly wealthy person is a rising block tariff structure that's based on the consumption of water. If there's a comparatively wealthier person in a single person household, they're likely to consume probably less than 6 kiloliters of water per month. Even though they're wealthy, they'll end up paying nothing for water. That's not the intention of policy in securing access to water services. However, there may be a poor household who doesn't have access to infrastructure to receive services, or doesn't have access to, or lives in a does receive services but lives in a large household that consumes far in excess of the 6 kiloliters of water per month, although the per capita consumption is very low. The per person consumption is low, but the total household consumption is very high, as you would find in many densely populated settlements and areas with large backyard shack populations. In that case, those households would effectively be excluded from the subsidy. One, because they're using far more than the minimum amount, and two, otherwise because they don't have access to the infrastructure in the first place to receive the subsidy. So that's what's called subsidy leakage. And one needs to make sure that these shortcomings do not outweigh the benefits of what is happening in the benefits of the current subsidy system, so that we are making sure that targeting is as accurate as possible. Secondly, the principles and practices guiding both tariff and subsidy structures, as well as the price levels for water, are made clear and are routinely monitored. The Water Services Act does go some way towards clarifying the principles that should guide tariff and price and subsidy setting in the sector, but there's very limited routine monitoring of the efficacy of this. The Treasury does collect some data, but I'm sure even by their own admission, the analysis of that data on household bills is by no means robust enough yet, and that does pose a risk for the sector going forward. Second recommendation is that while significant attention has been placed on water access to water services, the same really hasn't been the case in terms of access to sanitation services. Sanitation services arguably have as much, if not greater, positive public health impacts and are a critical part of any set of services that are provided at a community level. Yet access to sanitation, I think the global experience is not just around access to infrastructure. Providing people with a safe sanitation facility does not guarantee that they will necessarily use it, and does not guarantee that you will necessarily get the public health benefits that you're looking for from those investments. And the Commission recommends that government needs to look far more broadly than just at sanitation infrastructure in looking at universalizing access to sanitation. It needs to look at behavioral change. There's still, in rural areas, there are a number of communities without access to services or with limited access to services who will defecate in the open, posing a significant public health hazard. That needs to be, that is not something that, a change that just happens through saying, here's a toilet for everyone. It needs to accompany that with a set of behavioral changes that says, I want to take ownership of this facility, and I want to make sure that, that it's not just using the toilet, but hand washing and so forth goes alongside that. And here the government may want to explore more appropriate sanitation technologies, so it's not just focusing on the hardware, but on the software of behavioral change at the community level. And there have been some, I think, very interesting experiences in this in South Asia, India, Bangladesh, and so forth, that may be worth reflecting on. Finally, on water and sanitation, the Commission recommends that consideration be given to separating policy-making functions from the regulatory functions in the water services sector, specifically that a national water regulator reporting to Parliament be established that would license, regulate tariffs, monitor the investments in the sector at all levels, whether that be national, provincial, or local government. Provincial doesn't have a significant role in water. Would regulate compliance to the water industry norms and standards in terms of the quality of supply and so forth, would develop regulatory frameworks for partnerships with the private sector around the delivery of services and for alternative service delivery models that involve community-based supply mechanisms, as well as monitor demand and supply side trends in the sector. The concern or the recommendation for a autonomous water regulator comes from a concern that where national government is both setting policy targets and monitoring and regulating the targets and trying to build the capacity of service providers, water services authorities, which are municipalities. There is some opportunity there for slippage in terms of the policy targets themselves. So rather than intervening in the case, cracking the whip, as it were, in the case of a failure to achieve a target, national government may be more inclined to renegotiate the target, to slip back on the policy parameter. And a water regulator would help to hold the line in this respect. The final chapter of the recommendations deals with the, I think, a very vexed issue of the capacity support mechanisms in local governments. And some people have asked, subsequent to the release of these recommendations, why the Commission concerns itself with issues of capacity in local government. Isn't that got to do with the mandates of other agencies and so forth? And the Commission has been fairly clear that a large amount of public resources are channeled through the municipalities in this country, that their capacity to spend is at least in part, to spend these resources effectively, is at least in part a function of the support that is provided to them to enhance their own capacity. So that in a way one can see the capacity support programs of national government as being the key leveraging mechanism, the key the crowbar, as it were, to ensure that that all the other resources that are transferred through the equitable share, the municipal infrastructure grant, and a range of other sources are spent effectively. And I think that I think the Commission started off with, which perhaps in this terrain is an interesting perspective, is to say that it would be unfair to say that there has been a total failure in the local government system. A lot of the national discussion one hears in the newspaper, even among in national government policymaking forums, is that municipalities are a mess across the board. Well, the evidence doesn't actually support that. Some municipalities are experiencing challenges. Some are actually doing remarkably well. As a whole, system, the sphere has shown progress in expanding and improving the delivery of basic services. However, that is not to say that challenges don't remain. Significant challenges do remain. Certain municipalities remain unable to perform functions effectively due to capacity constraints of one type or another. And in some cases, this lack of capacity has led to intervention from national government through a series of capacity-building grants and programs. And the Commission really set out to understand how effective have these capacity-building programs been. Unfortunately, the answer is not very effective at all. There are far too many capacity-building programs. They've chopped and changed over time. Unsuccessful programs have often tended to emerge in new guises with little operational change. They're often not aligned to what the core objectives of government are. They're not aligned to particular problems that municipalities may be experiencing. They're very uncoordinated. They may be repetitive. They're often very reactive in terms of responding to problems. There's a duplication in the support that is offered across programs, so that there was a case of one district municipality where I think 8 different programs were providing support simultaneously, and 4 or 5 of them were specifically providing simultaneous support on revenue administration, and not working with each other in doing so. So I'll be prepared to wager a bet that there was not much improvement in revenue administration that went on in that municipality. But beyond that, these programs are often not sequenced in how they attempt to build and sustain the institutional capacity of municipalities, and they're very seldom effectively monitored or evaluated in terms of how effective they are in contributing to the sustainable development of municipal capacity. As a whole, this raises the risk that the programs, the net incentive So the worse you do, the more support you're going to get. And that is, in over the long to medium to long term, is certainly not an appropriate incentive for strengthening the capacity of municipalities as a whole. The better you do, the less likely you are to get support going forward. So there's a fundamental perverse incentive that is operating due to a uncoordinated, poorly sequenced, poorly designed system of capacity building support to municipalities. The Commission has some recommendations in this regard. It recommends that as a starting point, municipalities need to be at the center of setting their own agenda for building their capacity. They should not be treated as just beneficiaries of this process. They should be active leaders of the process of strengthening their own capacity. And prior to capacity building programs being developed and implemented, a comprehensive assessment of the problem and a design process of the kind of support that's going to be offered needs to be undertaken, not just at a national level, but also at a local government level. Capacity development programs need to be aligned to each stage of the transition of a municipality, from its embryonic stages, new municipalities, to ones that are struggling but moving forward, to fully fledged, fully operational municipalities. And that these capacity programs should be comprehensive. They shouldn't only focus on the deployment of personnel, as some do, or on personnel deployment of experts, or on the training of personnel. They need to take a far broader view on the establishment of effective systems of municipal governance and assist in establishing those systems, rather than perhaps taking away the responsibility of a municipality to establish and operate those systems, which I think is what happens in some cases when advisors are deployed to municipalities. Going forward, we also recommend that government needs to establish an intergovernmental-wide framework. This means a framework that is both between departments of national government and between the spheres of government, a shared understanding of what actually constitutes a lack of capacity within the context of local government. In some cases, poor performance by a municipality may not be due to a lack of capacity. It may be due to ill discipline in the municipal workforce. It may be due to a lack of commitment by councillors to oversee municipal administration, a lack of will to take action for misperformance, for poor performance. These are not capacity issues per se. They can often be management failures, and one must be sure that one doesn't confuse what are clearly capacity and inability to establish and maintain systems with just a basic lack of management discipline. There should be, the Commission also recommends that there's a clear separation of responsibilities in the provision of capacity support services by municipalities, by national and provincial governments, so that it is not a national department that is responsible for designing and implementing a capacity support program. At present, what happens is that a particular department will both design a program, implement it, and evaluate its performance. So if you look at any of the capacity support programs of national government, they all regard themselves as doing fairly well, because they are evaluating themselves, they've designed it themselves, and they're really the only person who's oversight about what's going on. And I think it's both unfair to those departments, quite frankly, though they may not admit it, but certainly to municipalities, to allow what is clearly cases of underperformance in some programs to go unchallenged. So a clear split needs to be made between those responsible for designing and monitoring programs to those responsible for actually implementing programs. It's also recommended that that poorly defined roles in capacity building between national, provincial governments and district municipalities be eliminated, because often you have all three spheres trying to focus in on one municipality and not really understand understanding their respective roles in relation to one another. The final slide, you'll be pleased to know, is that in the design of capacity building programs, the individual programs, the Commission recommends that there's a clear outline of measurable objectives, targets, and timelines for implementation and what is going to be achieved through implementation. The Commission doesn't recommend that there be a single capacity building grant framework, grant or transfer program, because I think it does recognize there are many different needs and many different players in the field. So that while some separation of grant instruments may remain appropriate, that does not remove the need for robust grant design. And the report looks at the performance of some of the individual programs. There's one program, the Municipal Systems Improvement Grant, which I think over the life of it's allocated about 200 million rand a year to spend, and is managed by the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. I think over its whole life, it's never failed. It's never managed to spend in excess of 60% of that allocation. Its argument has been that municipalities don't comply with its conditions. Quite frankly, to have a 40% miss rate, as it were, speaks to very poor program design, a very poor idea of what you want that program to do, and less to the compliance of municipalities. Well-managed programs, well-designed programs, very seldom get that level of underspending relative to their allocations. Finally, with regard to Sienzamanje, which is the flagship program of government and implemented through the Development Bank of Southern Africa, the Commission recommends that the financing of Sienzamanje be moved back within the purview of the Division of Revenue Act. At the moment, what is happening is that there's a single line item transfer from the Treasury vote at national level to the Development Bank for Sienzamanje. Beyond that, there's very little oversight, certainly by Parliament or the public, as to where that money is being spent, which municipalities are benefiting, which municipalities are not benefiting. So it's very difficult to imagine, it's very difficult to be able to measure the value for money that is being obtained from those allocations. The Division of Revenue, but moving the program back within the purview of the Division of Revenue Act would significantly increase the transparency of the allocations and ensure that a basic degree of discipline in program design was enforced on that program.
Thanks, David. Yeah. Chair, just quick review of what we are saying. At FFC, we have identified a number of challenges for the next 5 years, among which are resolving the matter of powers and functions across the three spheres of government, the fiscal capacity of provinces and municipalities, and the impact of transfers on the delivery of outcomes of government programs. I believe all these issues have become very clear in our presentation. But we also then want to say that in the next 5 years, the Commission's new strategic plan is quite heavily influenced by these challenges. Our submission has addressed a number of issues ranging from review of the PS formula to infrastructure and the built environment issues. The Commission has also paid specific attention to the matter of sustaining social assistance systems. But also elsewhere in our work, we have also witnessed a proliferation of grants. And most of us will recall that when we were coming into the new government, the Treasury was the loudest in saying that let us not throw money at problems. Let us look for non-financial solutions for all our problems before we can look for money. But it would look as if now the tendency is to look for money first and then wonder what the problem is. So we're really, moving away from where we started. And then also, there are lots of delays that result in policy uncertainties. One of them is the REDS.
you know, a big infrastructure is being maintained, supported, and so forth, but there's no progress in terms of the rates. And we find that more or less all over in the classification of roads, for example. If it is thought that a road will shift maybe from a province to national, that province stops funding that that road, and as a result, infrastructure gets deteriorates. And so forth. So these are just some of the issues that are really, to a great extent, institutional as well, and we believe that they need attention, and they will, of course, also some of them be part of our strategies. We have made recommendations, but in the next 5 years, these are some of the issues we'll be looking at. Chair, thanks very much. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sitai, and your team. Honourable members, there you have it. The point is, we must give people hope out there. And we're speaking now about 2010, 2011, the recommendations. In the last few sentences, the presenter actually captured the point in terms of management, non-financial solutions, Chairperson, which you mentioned. And it boils down to management, human resources, financial management, procurement, project management, etc. The money is there, it's somewhere in the pockets, not people's pockets, but in the budgets. Unspent money. If you recall the presentation made by the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry when we dealt with the budgets, 60 million rand were not spent from the CASP funds. Money in the pocket, it was lying somewhere. It was not utilized. It's underspending. To come to the point the Honorable Chairperson made, there's other solutions that is not financial. It's about management. The second thing is, our oversight role is becoming more important seeing the issues listed here. And yesterday we made our inputs at that workshop also regarding the program of the NCOP. We will have to relook our oversight program of this institution of parliament to go and check what is happening outside. We can talk about it, yes, but we must do a check outside. Honourable members, there's time enough for questions. I will take the list. Honourable Harris, Honourable Khoro, Honourable Mashile, Honourable Nguni. Anyone else? I visited my constituency the past 14 days. I've got 55 kilometers of tar road and the rest is gravel roads. Just to give you an idea, talking about roads, it's quite a challenge to do your constituency work on poor gravel roads. But we have to do it and bring the issues here. Just to get to the practicality of it. Honourable Harris, you can kick off.
Thank you, Chair. I have many, quite a few questions, but I'll keep them very short, and most of them are technical. The first few aren't, though. Just a question of many of the members here, including myself, are new. What is the FSC's experience in the adoption of your recommendations year on year? Can you give me some idea of your experience with Treasury and how often recurring recommendations come up? I haven't seen last year's submission, but how similar is it, is basically what I'm asking. Then there's right throughout your recommendations, there's increases in expenditure. What I'm wondering is, are you also taking into account the revenue collection side, especially given the fact that revenues are going to be lower this year, given the recession, I don't think I read much at all on the revenue side. My third question is, there's a concern raised about the FFC being non-existent in the budget process. That sounds unbelievable to me. Can you please explain how it is possible that the FFC is non-existent in the budget process? And then just in the first few pages of the presentation, on page 6, you talk about the potential for provincial revenue raising. Can you explain a little bit about why the provinces aren't exploiting revenue raising powers, and how you foresee that they could? Also on that page, you talk about the ability of provinces to borrow, and obviously there's a problem with provinces not borrowing. Why are they not borrowing? And how do we encourage them to do that? On page 7, you talk about the concept of revenue sharing. Can you just explain that to me, the revenue sharing component? It's specifically with regard to the idea that the economic activity component is removed from the provincial equitable share. Can you just explain that concept to me? I'm almost finished here. And then on page 5, with regards to the review, you talk about the TCF. What is the TCF? And this review that you're undertaking, how many years will it take, and what are the timeframes? This is with regards to the provincial equitable share formula. And you speak about a review that happened in 2004. Is this a continuation of that review, or what are the lessons from that 2004 review? And then my last question is, on page 8, you speak of a recommendation in the medium term to introduce an equalization grant. Can you just explain what that would be? That's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Harris. Honorable Mahoru.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I thought maybe you were going to allow the team to answer those quite a lot of questions. Yeah. My first question, Comrade Chair, will be how the FFCs foresee provinces increasing their revenue raising capacity without creating more burden on the taxpayers. And then the following question will be, if provinces borrow, as it was suggested in the first presentation, how will they be able to service their loans while they are still depending on the funding from national? The third question will be, how long do we envisage social grants to last before we have our people being self-sufficient? Because it seems nowadays emphasis is on social grant, whilst I think that emphasis should be on, you know, promoting our people to become self-sufficient. And the last question, Comrade Chair, is regarding deterioration of roads. Before there was a squad under one of the government departments which was permanently working on roads, upgrading roads, repairing, and even building new roads. And that was a government department with all the necessary equipment. But it seems nowadays we more looking at getting private companies to come and do these things with exorbitant charges and so forth. And to me, if we can go back probably to that type of thing, we could see a permanent team being there looking after the roads, repairing and upgrading, and sometimes even building new roads. And in that too, we can also have skills development, because people who are coming to work there can be, you know, be developed in particular skills. And that is my view. Thank you, Comrade Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mukhuru, Honorable Mashile.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just hope that there will be a high level of patience for me to talk a little bit longer. I hope that on many things that I would raise, very, 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 very few issues may be nonsense. Chairperson, the first thing I think that I just wanted to talk to is just to know the FFC. When was it constituted? How long is it still going to last? And of course, is the following from the question that I've, that was raised, but more directly is how authoritative are the recommendations of the FFC? And I think at the beginning of the slide, I think I've seen that it has got 9 members, and but the constitution I think looks like it's talking to about 18. Or other 9 members as well. I'm not sure whether it has been revised. I'll be informed. What is there that's happening? Chair, to come to page 11. Page 11, then there are 2 statements that I can't make sense out of them, unless if maybe somebody explains to me. There is a reduction in both individual and household poverty in relation to the grants, but just below, under labor market, and then we say it creates dependency and may put entire households into poverty. At the top, we said the households, there is a reduction of poverty. But at the bottom, we say, no, it's taking these households to poverty. And I think there will be a need for a little bit of a clarification. And on page 14, this is a buzzword that we have been hearing from technocrats. They really talk about the word independence, where we have got the evidence suggests that reforms aimed at granting hospitals more independence. Just to understand independent from what? Or what sort of independence are we talking about? Because if we are referring to state hospitals, and then we talk about independence, are we not suggesting privatization? Probably, maybe the explanation would assist me. And then on page 18, Chairperson, the administration of housing subsidies. I just want to hear the views from the FFC whether it is not appropriate that they be cascaded down to local authorities, because I think at the moment those housing subsidies are managed at provincial level, and you have got all sorts of problems in releasing those funds in time and approving projects in time, and the local municipalities, which are the face of our delivery, have got absolutely no control over it, other than just identifying sites and land, and that's it. But the funding is a little bit cumbersome. I just wanted to understand that, Chair. Then on page 22, the issue relating to roads funding, cost recovery, or generate sufficient revenue, I'm sure the FFC is aware about the problems in the Eastern Cape or whatever is the called Garden Route or whatever, about the toll road that was supposed to be put in there, that there is a general rejection of toll roads. And then how do they their research, how does it integrate this particular recommendation to the general trend of rejecting the toll roads, actually? And if we can just be briefed on that. The lack, on page 23, the lack of technical skills. It is referred to road management sector, whatever, but I mean,
level of technical skills, I'm sure it's across all infrastructure development. And is this not talking to movement of technically qualified people from public service? Because one is made to understand that there are quite a lot of technically qualified people out there, but majority of them are located in the private sector rather than the public sector. And was there any sort of research that has been made in relation to the causes that makes people to move from local government, provincial government, national government to private sector? Because even nowadays, I think we are seeing even newly qualified technical people not staying in public sector, straight going across to private sector. Is it not something that relates to salaries and whatever, as the doctors have already informed you informally? I think, Chairperson, that yeah, the second but last chair, the suggestion of a new of a national water regulator. I need to be convinced here, because there are so many institutions or agencies within the Division of Water Affairs, whether in agricultural or whatever, that are trying to manage water distribution and all those other things, catchment management agencies, whatever we can call them. The suggestion of a national water regulator, does not that inform the disestablishment of other agencies, which it has to take it their responsibilities? I think, because, Chair, we must watch out that every time, every year, and every sitting where you've got the executive and its officials, there is a creation of an agency. Every time. They want to create agencies across the world. Now, some of these are actually duplications, also following the same trend of these grants and the monitoring, where you've got every minister wants to create a particular grant, and then which overlaps on another grant. If we can be informed that which agencies will then be disestablished when we establish this particular one. Chair, I've already talked about this one on the capacity, the lack of capacity on page 30. That as much as national government is putting capacity into the local municipalities, those people that start having the capacity, then they jump into private sector. So we're facing a bottomless drum or bottomless sack. That I'm sure all municipalities at the moment, I don't know what informs that. You'll find that in all municipalities there are educational programs for councillors, for officials, and I'm not sure why a councillor will find attending a course on human resources, you know, that deals with actual personnel administration. If a councillor attends that particular course, after finishing that, and then he jumps to a private sector. And I don't know, is that this capacity building, as you are saying, they are not correctly focused for specific duties that certain individuals are engaged in for them to be able to perform their task. It is just simply a training program. You know, it's... but my problem is that all those, although it's not bad for them to happen to be financed, they actually capacitate people to jump out of the public service into private sector and eventually not assist the intention. Whether it's the FFC is actually assisting or picking it up in their researches. On page 33, I think I did not understand, Chair, the middle paragraph, where there is a clear separation of responsibilities between service authority and service providers. Well, what we were trying to say, I'm sure maybe if you can, I can get more clarity on there, because I thought that a service authority like a municipality, in most cases also it is a service provider in terms of refuse removal and all those. It is only in certain instances where this authority will employ a service provider who is an outsider, the private sector. Probably, if I can just get that, whether this statement is not referring, it's not a blanket statement. It refers where you have got a separate service provider and a service authority. Yes. No, thanks, Chairperson.
Honorable Nguni.
Thank you, Chair. I think Chair should commission Honorable Masile as a professional engineer to restate the squad to rehabilitate our roads and be on new roads again. Chair, on a light, note, I just want to find out on slide number 11, you are saying that the crimes actually are dragging the premise into poverty. However, the studies by economic scholars have indicated that families get grants actually stand a better opportunity to get employment and to improve their lives, of which is contradicts the statements or what you're saying in slide number 11. I just want to get an understanding on that. Or as the evolution of communities change, have we now found that it's actually the opposite? Just want to find that, like, the scholars like Todaro who are saying actually basically all communities that are getting grants, it has been proved globally, they got the better access to improve themselves than families don't get grants. On the issue of health, I just want to find out the envisaged NHI, what will be the impact of NHI as compared to all the problems that you are showing us in the provision of health services. And then on roads, I just want to find out what will be the impact of the Transnet program of 70 billion rand that is going to purchase rolling stock, because studies have found that more roads have become damaged because transporting of goods and services, or transporting of goods actually, has shifted from the rail to the roads because of heavy trucks and stuff like that. Roads become more damaged. And also the implementation of toll roads, most of the heavy loaded trucks, they now decide to avoid these toll roads and they use the smaller artillery roads, of which are further damaged roads. Now, what is the impact, really the impact of these 70 billion rand from Transnet, and how much percentage of the toll road fees is used actually to maintain these other roads other than toll roads? My next question is on the on local government. I just want to find out what was the impact, or what is the impact of the Siyenza Manje program that was initiated by National Treasury through the DBSA, as they are giving the grants through DBSA to local municipalities. And also felt that your statement that if you can just clarify the statement on slide number 32, as Honorable Mashile said, you, other than capacitating those personnel, what other broader issues do you envisage that could further improve service delivery in municipalities? The statement on slide number 32. If you can just, the last bullet, if you can just clarify that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nguni. Honorable members, we will have the opportunity to engage with departments, but also when we deal with the annual reports and quarterly reports. And the question that we must ask, looking at the
lack of skills in the technical fields. The Department of Transport, do they give bursaries to students who want to go study engineering, road engineering, water affairs, civil engineering, electrical engineering, etc.? That's where the shortages are. We must ask those questions. When we visit our schools, our high schools in our constituency, ask the principal, September, give me a list of your grade 12s that want to go and study. In which field? Bring them in contact with the institutions that give bursaries. Old Mutual is giving bursaries. They've got the Education Trust. I didn't know it. I learned it in the past 3 weeks. It's also our responsibility to connect our people with resources to go further. Honorable Dr. Sitai, you can respond. We've got enough time to do it. And there's lots of questions.
Plenty, yes. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And yes, it's actually a lot of questions. Some require reflection, but others are fairly straightforward. So we'll answer those that we can, and then others, then we can answer them during our next visit. But I also want to say, Mr. Chairman, that SFFC, if it's all appropriate, we are also available to come now for a workshop where we all, you know, discuss all these issues in a workshop and share views and so forth. We are available for that. I think I'll start with Mr. Mashile's questions, some of them anyway, before I pass on to my colleagues. The first question was, you know, what is FFC? As the chair says, the FFC was established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution, and it provides independent, impartial advice to Parliament, the provincial legislatures, and organized local government on the division of nationally raised revenue to provincial and local governments. Now, division of of nationally raised revenue, it is really very important, because we know that, Mr. Mokhoro, you are saying, where will the provinces get money from? The issue is that most of our taxes are pulled up to national, and then national then must distribute the revenue in a very equitable way. So the FFC ensures that through its advice that happens. But now, how strong is the FFC? It's as strong as the Constitution initially, upfront. The Constitution gives it a mandate that it should give advice that is independent, impartial, and impartial. But when you come to the operations, the FFC is as strong as Parliament wants it to be. You know, we actually are a creature of Parliament, of the Constitution, I'm sorry, but we report to Parliament. And the Parliament then has to ensure that we are strong. How are we strong? One, Parliament would have to protect us from people who attack us. You know, people who think that we are giving advice that is not in order, we should stay out. You know, Parliament can protect us there because the Constitution makes it possible for Parliament to protect us. Secondly, Parliament can ensure that we are well funded. In fact, we should be getting our budget from Parliament, but practice has it such that we get our budget from the Treasury. And you know that he who pays the Pied Piper calls the truth. You know, to a great extent, we are independent, but at the same time, we can be held back by not being given sufficient funds. And then that way, then, we cannot, you know, do our work. So, in essence, then, we are saying our funding, Parliament is important. Then, the broadening of our mandate is also an issue that Parliament can ensure that, you know, our mandate is broadened, because we are controlled by legislation, so we do pretty much what legislation says. But if Parliament feels that we are too limited in what we do, then Parliament can do that. You know, and it would be, Chair, in those workshops where we can discuss these issues with the members and indicate where, you know, we can use some help from Parliament. And then the other issue is, for example, Section 214 requires consultation with the FFC before passing the Division of Revenue Bill. That happens every year. You know, we do have comments every year on the Division of Revenue Bill. But we have to then ensure that there are no slippages of certain issues where we are not consulted, because on a lot of issues, we have to be consulted. Sections 218, 228, 229, and 230 of the Constitution require the FFC to be consulted on issues pertaining to government guarantees, subnational debt, provincial taxes, and municipal fiscal powers. You know, all these issues, we have to be consulted. And sometimes if they just fly past us, they can easily create problems down the line. Now, what happens is, Mashile, to our recommendations. Our recommendations, when we finish them, we submit them immediately to two stakeholders. One, the Treasury, and two, Parliament. We do them on the same day. You know, they get them on the same day. But however, the way we work with the Treasury, it's an ongoing process. So that throughout the year, we are consulting, we are, you know, they fairly know. By the time we give them a packaged recommendation, they pretty much have an idea of what is in there. The idea is just to ensure that there are no surprises, to ensure that there are no tensions, to ensure that the Treasury will make provisions to budget for our recommendations. So that when Treasury eventually comes here, Treasury can say, okay, of the FFC recommendations, we agreed on 70% of them because we can fund them, or, you know, government does thought of them before, or whatever, you know, that kind of situation happens. So that's why our recommendations then go to Treasury 10 months before the time. Now, Mr. Nkola, on the issue of 10 provinces raise revenue that will not increase the burden, the truth is that you know, a tax is a tax. You know, in economics, the definition of a tax is very easy. It is called forced payment. You know, and that's really what it is. So, if provinces should raise extra taxes, it will be because they want to perform a certain function, and on that basis, they need money to pay for that function. So one cannot think of a tax really that will not increase the burden on the people. So the issue of loans then becomes a big issue, because provinces are not in business of making money. So we cannot say they will you know, impose a tax, or they'll get a loan, produce something and pay back. You know, somebody will have to pay for those loans. And perhaps the only other way is for us to be taxed further, you know, to pay for the loans. Now, the Western Cape, we did advise them on what is called a fuel levy. We did submit our advice. Again, we don't know what the province has decided to do on that. Issue of social grants, now, you know, some of the issues, my colleagues can go back on them and just, you know, re-strengthen them, so to speak. But the issue of social grants, how long, I think it's a political issue. You know, the politicians would have to decide how long they will do the social grants. In terms of our technical analysis, we are saying they are fine in terms of where they make an impact, But in terms of the sustainability of the money to continue to go that way becomes the issue of the treasury. You know, that must then indicate, you know, whether in fact that can happen. We could do it, but it's not necessarily our mandate, you know, to do that. It's the mandate of the treasury to talk on that. The issue of deterioration of roads, we were with Minister Deutsch yesterday, public works, yeah, right. These are the issues he's thinking about, and issues of maintenance of infrastructure and so forth. So we are certain that when the roads people come, he had indicated that he might ask them to, you know, one person to come, I don't know whether he's here, they should be able to comment on that. Right. Now, I will pass on to my colleague David to pick up, you know, things. I've left them very neatly in that, you know, Mr. Harris, you can answer all his questions, and Mr. Mashili had plenty, and Gwini also. You know. Right. And then the colleagues, you come in. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Thanks, Pop. I'll try my best, but I may not hit everything right on the head in terms of how I took notes of the various questions that were asked. I think Dr. Stier has talked through issues on the role of the Commission. Just to add that it's beyond the Constitution, it's empowered in terms of the FFC Act, which I think is from 96 or 97, it's from the first Parliament, and then the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. The Commission is also mentioned in a number of other acts to do with provincial and local government, and even with the budget process. The recent Money Bills Amendment Act has a role for the Commission and so forth. So, but I think it all falls within the frame that is created by the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act and the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act. So that's the kind of empowering frame. I think what distinguishes this commission in South Africa from our international peers, of which there are many, is really the model that's been adopted in South Africa, which is as a permanent advisory commission. Now, other models have a less permanent structure. So, for example, in India, the Finance Commission is constituted once every 5 years for a period of about 18 months. So they set up this huge infrastructure to do a whole lot of analysis and technical work, and then they deconstruct it again. It's not a particularly efficient way of doing it, in my view. Yet that commission, the Indian Commission, it's an advisory commission, but there's a protocol that has been in place since 1952, I think, was their first commission, where the recommendations have been adopted wholesale by government in respect of the essentially awards to the state governments of India, of which there are many. In Uganda, the Fiscal Commission actually is a permanent commission but determines the formula for allocations of resources of all programs to local governments that are in the provinces, and actually makes those allocations. It actually transfers the money. So you can see that there are roles. What we have in South Africa is a permanent commission, which I think is a good model in my view, to allow to attract and retain kind of technical research capacity and build systems, but it's advisory in nature. So it's an impartial expert committee. And that probably is also partially an answer to some of the questions that were asked, especially by Mr. Nguni, was have we thought about the national health insurance and some other things? We have thought about them, but we haven't finished our research on them, and a role of an expert commission is to avoid giving what we think is a good idea at the moment, but to actually go through a process of fairly rigorous investigation and research that is within a pre-planned research cycle that looks into the medium term, not into the immediate issues of the day. So we spend a lot of time trying to judge what the appropriate issues are going to be to comment on in any budget cycle, We've got to be thinking 2 years in advance in how we do that, so to make sure that our recommendations are at least current by the time that those research programs have ended. So we have thought of this question of national health insurance and some of the implications that the FFC may want to needs to consider. It's very difficult to move on it because there are no firm proposals on the table at this point. It's already planned, it's programmed into our current research cycle going forward. So in a way, I think as an expert, long-standing commission, our role is to try and look slightly over the horizon in as much as we can. By the time that issues come on the table, we're able to offer some impartial, well-considered advice on those issues. It's not always easy. I think it's more difficult when you get over an electoral period and then you get new representatives and you get a refreshed mandate in Parliament and so forth, so that a lot of issues come onto the table, some of which you hadn't foreseen 2 years ago. But we try our best. In terms of Mr. Harris's question on the extent of the adoption of recommendations, I would say it's fairly good. I think that one's got to distinguish between the policy recommendations of the Commission and the actual details of implementation, which can take a number of years to roll out. And we fully understand from the Commission side that we may be slightly ahead of the curve in some recommendations that take a while to percolate down through the system. Mr. Machida raised the issue of the housing program and its current performance by provincial governments rather than local governments. This is an issue that the Commission commented on 3 years ago. I think it was three or maybe 2 years ago on the question of municipal accreditation and so forth. I think there's been a growing head of steam to say, now we need to address this issue and do it comprehensively. While we do try and keep a score sheet, as it were, one's got to take a longer-term view as well on exactly when things are taken up. And no, our recommendations aren't identical every year at all. I mean, we'd hate to just put you to sleep entirely. They do change with the times. We try and judge what current issues are likely to be, what we regard as strategic issues in the intergovernmental fiscal system. My own experience is I think that the Treasury does focus on the recommendations of the Commission and does engage very robustly with them, which is something that we welcome. But the other departments that the robustness of the engagement is not always as great. So one can make recommendations, for example, on the question of the housing program and just hits a kind of wall of silence when it comes to the Department of Housing and how it will respond. And Treasury, it doesn't obviously have all the, can't just move unilaterally. It would need to move in conjunction with with the relevant sector departments. So overall, I think that our experience with the recommendations has been fairly good, given that there's no protocol of kind of universal adoption. There's some other things on the Commission is that, in fact, the Commission's powers have not been fully explored, even in terms of what they're granted granted under the Act and the Constitution. The Commission is able to mediate in the case of intergovernmental disputes and so forth. It's never really been called on to do that. We can, I think we're also empowered to demand evidence from governments. We've never had to do that because we've had typically have very high levels of cooperation and so forth. So that's never been an issue. On this question of provincial revenue raising,
Shigwani?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on this issue of consultation with departments or recommendations to departments other than National Treasury, are there communication lines or clear communication lines that is between yourselves and departments, any department, housing,
There are, but obviously they're not working as effectively as they could. I mean, I think that that would be probably the experience on both sides of the fence there. I think from the commission side, the difficulty has been that the commission is a small commission with limited resources and doesn't focus on every issue every year, just because we simply don't have the capacity to do that. So there may be a long gap before you would come back to an issue on, say, hypothetically housing, although housing is something that tends to keep a focus going. So that in that case, the channel tends to degrade. I think the commission has realized that it's not just the departments that need to be blamed, but we need to also adjust ourselves to the environment, and our new research strategy is looking specifically at how we do engage more directly with a broader group of stakeholders rather than just Treasury and Parliament and the provincial legislatures, which has been the focus in the past, and saying, listen, we want to make a contribution to shifting policy outcomes. So therefore we need to make sure that the work that we do is as widely known as possible, and we need to build into our research design process dissemination, engagement, and so forth, and that is happening. So we're trying to stop behaving like kind of backroom researchers scribbling away and getting out more and engaging with our stakeholders, which would include departments in that respect. Just on the question of revenue raising powers, I think there were a couple of questions around that. There is limited potential for revenue raising by provinces. You've got to remember that the vast bulk of their expenditure responsibilities are on health and education, and those are funded most appropriately off the national tax base to ensure universal and a kind of universal equitable standard of access to services. But that doesn't mean that there aren't revenue opportunities that could arise from specialist medical interventions or whatever, kind of user fees and so forth. There is a provincial fiscal powers bill, act, I mean, and there's also a provincial borrowing powers act. They haven't been extensively exploited today. There is the case of the Western Cape's application for the fuel levy, which Dr. Satai mentioned earlier. The main kind of independent tax currently levied by provinces is gambling, isn't it? And it's very small as a percentage of total revenue. 96-97% of total revenues of provinces are generated are derived from grants, the equitable share, and other grants from national government, far higher than the average for municipalities. So there's kind of limited room, in essence. One doesn't want a whole bunch of nuisance taxes to emerge at the provincial level, kind of dog license taxes, and I don't know, you can get a large number of very small, not very productive tax instruments in place, which become an administrative burden predominantly for the taxpayer, as well as becoming a site of creating opportunities for corruption and so forth. Why are the provinces not borrowing? I think that's by convention at this point, because the Provincial Borrowing Powers Act does now exist, and there is a process by which they can borrow. One's got to remember, because they are borrowing, the primary security that provinces have in their borrowing is the transfers from national governments. The liability that they're imposing is essentially a liability on the national balance sheet. That's like, unlike municipalities, which are large cities, like for example Cape Town, is not particularly reliant on national government for money at all. I think it's about 12% of its total revenue. So a large part of its borrowing is financed through own source revenues, user charges, property taxes, and so forth. They haven't been borrowing because these things have been funded by national government. They haven't been encouraged to borrow. The debate has essentially got two legs to it. The first is a leg that says that it's not particularly efficient for provinces to borrow when national could just borrow the money and pass it on, and it'll borrow at cheaper rates. here, so please forgive me. The second side of the argument says, no, hold on, by borrowing, you're enforcing a degree of discipline that the lender is going to say, well, what are you borrowing my money for, and how are you sure you're going to repay it, and are you making a sensible investment, and is it well designed? You know, so if you're building a stadium, have you thought through when you need that money to come and so forth? And what we typically find in the public sector is that the detail of program design is actually quite weak. People are not thinking through the very detailed aspects of how they're managing their supply chain, both in terms of goods, materials, and labor, as well as financing. So they may borrow money, draw it all down, sit there, and the money just sits in a current account earning almost no interest, and they're paying on the debt because they've drawn the money down already. So but the lenders will typically not want that to happen. So there's an opportunity that a borrowing process brings to bring discipline to the project design process by a subnational government. So those are the two sides of the argument. That improved discipline that borrowing to fund a particular infrastructure investment and the kind of hurdles you have to jump over, does that bring value for money benefits that outweigh what will probably be a higher cost of borrowing, higher interest rates that would be charged to a subnational entity? I'm really bastardizing the debates, but that's at their core. And to some extent, that's still unresolved, and I think provinces seem to have largely taken the view that it's better to let national borrow and pass it on to us through grants. But that may change. That calculation may change. Revenue sharing was another question that was asked. Just to add to Dr. Sato's point on the question of how can provinces increase revenues without increasing the burden on taxpayers, the one way that is likely to happen is that national government would forego some revenues. So, for example, it may say, well, if you're going to allow a personal, if provinces are allowed to have a personal income tax, hypothetically, of 5% of personal income, national will drop its personal income tax by that 5%. One would want to make sure that it's broadly off the same base, otherwise you can have distributional impact. So you could drop VAT from 14% to 9%, but the burden of who's actually paying and who's actually benefiting changes if you do it in that way. So there is an opportunity to forego revenues by national government and say, well, you now generate that, and we're going to replace the own revenues. We're going to allow you to replace our grants, essentially, with own revenues from taxes. So it's a fairly complicated debate. I could certainly go into it in more detail if you'd like me to. And there are benefits, like there are benefits from borrowing to increasing the reliance of provinces on their own revenues, because they're more directly accountable to the people who pay the taxes. At the moment, they pay through national government. It comes to provinces largely as a grant. The revenue sharing, quite simply put, revenue sharing is a system where a revenue instrument is collected nationally. So that could be personal income tax. It's collected nationally, and then it's distributed to subnational governments, most typically on the basis of the source where it was collected. But when it comes to equalization, so in that case, if I collect 100 billion rand from a particular tax source, I can, and 10 billion of that came from the Free State, I would transfer 10 billion to the Free State. So we're essentially sharing an administrative framework, and it's tagged back to source. That's the most direct instrument of direct revenue sharing instrument. But one can start to introduce an equalization framework to that. An equalization framework is essentially one that allows you to recognize that differing areas of the country have different capacities to raise revenues, but they have the same basic expenditure requirements. So, for example, universal basic health care costs pretty much the same all over the country in terms of primary health care. Therefore, you're trying to use an equalization formula to match, to distribute redistribute money from comparatively wealthier areas who are able to pay more, in our case our cities, to comparatively poorer areas who face the same expenditure responsibilities, and that's basically an equalization framework. And for the local government equitable share and the local government infrastructure grant, MIG, for example, are both fairly heavily equalizing in their intent in the way that they allocate funding. The TCF is the Technical Committee on Finance, which is an administrative committee staffed with government officials who report to the Budget Council and the Budget Forum. Acronyms can get very confusing. I will leave the questions of the PES in particular to Eddie, because I think that you'll give a better answer on those things and social grants. Mr. McCorra raised the question around the shift to private companies in road maintenance and road construction and maintenance activities. I think that there has been probably a noticeable shift just by driving around. I think that most municipalities and provinces have done that on a cost-benefit basis. They've found that that just simply it's cheaper for them in the long run than holding personnel on their payrolls, because roadworks are quite seasonal. You can't do them during periods of heavy rain, for example. You just save money by not having a full-time workforce on that in every municipality. And you save money because you're essentially renting the equipment for the periods that you need it. That being said, I know that, for example, Etiquini has recently it got out of the bitumen manufacturing business, like manufacturing the tar for roads, and just purely bought it in from private plants. It's now decided that costs from the private plants have grown too rapidly, and so it's reopened one of its old bitumen facilities, not to close down the private sector, but so it has a benchmark against the private sector, and that can help it to negotiate lower prices in the contracting. So I think that while there has been a shift to contracting frameworks, the municipalities, the larger municipalities certainly are now becoming more intelligent about how they manage that as a long-term relationship effectively, because it's not a panacea to all the ills. Contracts need to be managed, one needs to set prices within them and so forth. I think probably the final question. Oh no, there was. This question that came up, and Mr. Mashile, you asked it, and so I think that someone else, but I can't quite see where I wrote it. Was this question of what? Why more independence? Why the separation in the case of local governments? Why more independence in the case of the hospitals? And who the independence is from. I mean, I think that you certainly shouldn't look at independence as some kind of secessionist activity on behalf of the hospital. What we're really talking about there is managerial autonomy to manage within a clear framework of standards and targets. What happens at the moment in public hospitals, and it's exactly the same in the case of these local government capacity building programs, is no one's really accountable for the hospital outcomes. The managers in hospitals don't have enough discretion to buy light bulbs or gloves, surgical gloves. So they will. It's very difficult to then say, but the health outcomes in this hospital are terrible. Well, part of the reason for that is I'm not being given any authority here, any discretion to make any real choices. So it's not a question of privatization. Ownership is not the issue here at all in both of these issues. We're talking about systems of public ownership. There's no debate around that. It's really a question of the degree of autonomy. Now, it's very difficult to hold someone accountable if you restrain them from achieving something in the first place by the rules that you, or the decisions that you don't let them make. So if I don't let you procure basic minor goods, light bulbs, paper, whatever, surgical gloves, I can't then say, well, your health outcomes are inadequate in this hospital, because money and say, well, I was never given the power to actively use my resources to achieve those outcomes. I always have to come back to you for an approval for this or an approval for that. So one wants to make sure that one clearly divides the responsibilities of the agent, which in this case is the hospital, and the principal, which in most cases the provincial the provincial departments of health, so that they are able to set a target for a particular hospital, set service standards, set performance targets for those hospitals, and those hospitals then have enough discretion to go out and find ways to achieve those targets and be held accountable for the outcome associated with it. Now, when one looks at so basically what we're saying, without clearly defined authority at the level of the agency, it's very, very difficult to hold them accountable for any outcome at the end of the day, because they can always blame someone else for not doing their job. So you want to kind of, in a way, can I say, centralize accountability around the hospital rather than trying to centralize accountability at the level of a provincial department where it's too diffuse for a particular hospital anyway. When it comes to local government capacity building programs, what we are essentially saying is that there's a service authority, a provincial or a national department, which is running a program of capacity building. Let's take the National Treasury, because they're sitting in the room. They run a program called the Municipal Financial Management Technical Assistance Program, which is associated with the financial management grant that goes to municipalities. Now, the Treasury both designs the framework for that grant and manages its implementation and monitors and evaluates that grant program. They think it's going really well. And the reason being is that they are the judge, jury, and executioner all at the same time. There's very little independent oversight. What we're saying is that there needs to be a much clearer firewall between the department that's responsible for setting the policy framework, designing a program of capacity support, and those that go and implement it, so that we can get some kind of accountability for what's actually happening. Because in this domain of municipalities, we want to see measurable improvements in capacity, in institutional capacity that should lead to improved service delivery outcomes. We've got nothing to measure at the moment, and we can't attach any of what we can measure to any particular program either, because all the programs are doing everything, and there's no clear framework of oversight that's saying this program is responsible for, in the next year, making sure every municipality submits its financial statements on time. No one's responsible for seeing that. No, there's nothing that's measurable, because there's no separation of those roles. So I think that there's a common thread that runs across the recommendations of the Commission this year, is to say, yes, you must have a clear separation of roles so that we can be clear who's accountable for achieving what. And then we can find ways to hold those people accountable. I realize that's a much longer debate, and I'm happy probably afterwards to go into it with you in more detail, because there are a number of aspects to it. One of which is the introduction of the notion of an autonomous regulator that would then, in a sense, referee the relationship between the program designer and the program implementer, and make sure that neither side is unfairly treated in that process. I don't want to, on this question of the technical skills, which was I think another important issue raised, we haven't, as the Commission, done enough work on this question, and we haven't, I don't think we've seen it as directly central to our mandate, although as we rethink that in our new research strategy, it does come more into focus. What I would point members to is an excellent book by Alison Lawless on numbers and needs in local government that some of you may have heard of, and it looks specifically at why there is a skills shortage, where these skills are, and how what some of the strategies are for municipalities to address skill shortages across the various sectors, whether it be roads, whether it be whether it be water and so forth. I mean, I think some of the problems that are identified in that book is, as the chair said, there's literally not enough training. We don't have a large enough pipeline of young, motivated engineers who want to go out there and get experience. That every loss is an absolute loss to the system because it's not being made up by an equal number of entrants the following year. So I think that she certainly in that book calls for an urgent boosting in the number of entrants, kind of entry level professionals in engineering disciplines. And I think another problem has been that's led to high turnover among engineers is that they found often through the local government transition to be a very unstable and quite politicized environment. And if they can get out of that environment and go and work for a private sector firm, they find that more comfortable. Wages may be higher, but not always. It really depends on where you are in your career progression. And certainly the quality of the working environment is something that's typically always played into the favor of the public sector, which has great working conditions relative to the better working conditions relative to the private sector. That salary is partially compensated for by salaries. So it's not. I think the instability in local government, which is hopefully largely a thing of the past moving forward, has been an issue for engineers who typically, in my experience, just like to kind of sit down and get the work done in a very kind of no-nonsense way. Don't like to talk about anything other than the alignment of the road. On the question of a national water regulator, you'd raised the question of that we have already too many institutions in the water sector. I couldn't agree with you more. I think the question we need to ask is, where are those institutions? Because there aren't any catchment agencies. They've been created many years ago in the Act, but none of them have actually been established. There are a number of water boards, many of which are very dysfunctional. These are service provider agencies, and their role relative to municipalities is ambiguous at best. There are really only, I think, about four or five of the 20-something water boards that are actually viable water boards. And they remain, to me, quite mysterious institutions. I don't really know what goes on there half the time. So I think ultimately it's a question of roles. What you have in the water sector is a lot of service-providing agencies, catchment managers, water boards. You have the Tunnel Authority, Trans-Caledon Tunnel Authority, and so forth. You don't really have anyone other than the department exercising oversight over these agencies. So the department does try and regulate how water boards, for example, set their bulk water prices. It's not as effective, I think, even by the Department of Water Affairs' own admission. It's not a particularly effective mechanism of oversight, and in our view of the Commission, unlikely at this point to be adequately mitigating risks that prices are being set wrong. In other words, prices largely in the water sector are being set too low relative to the level of investment the sector actually needs. So it's a question of getting focused capacity into the sector in a role that is around oversight, not service delivery, that I think is what distinguishes the proposal for a national water regulator from just creating another service-providing agency out there. It's really to make sure that those agencies perform their functions effectively, whether they be municipalities, whether they be water boards, whether they be catchment management agencies, quite frankly, whether they be the water user associations, and so forth. There are a lot of providers. There's really no one exercising adequate oversight. I think that has. The final question was on the impact of the Sienza Manje program. It's very difficult to measure. I know that this is an issue the Treasury is concerned with, and the Sienza Manje program, together with Treasury have agreed now that they're going to do an independent evaluation in the short term, and I think that should certainly should be something that I would recommend that this committee strongly supports, so that we can actually get it and learn as much as we can from the experience of the Siemens Manje program. And I'm sure there has been a lot of learning and a lot of honest effort to get things right. But at this point, we really don't know what the impact is because it's just far too opaque about what's been going on there. What are some of the issues beyond training and so forth? Well, I think that training for me is really a secondary input to what a core concern is around building the basic systems of public expenditure management at municipal level. So those are the basic administrative billing systems, price setting and billing systems on the revenue side, credit control systems, budgeting systems, and then the financial management procurement systems that actually allow for the execution of expenditures once budgets have been approved. What one wants to make sure is that there is robust systems covering operating budgets, and on the capital side that you're establishing a very robust multi-year pipeline of capital projects. And there's no municipality, no organ of state in public agency that should not have a three-year capital project pipeline that allows it to spend its resources on a very predictable, pre-planned basis. Yet, that's not the case in many of our municipalities. So these are systems issues. They're not. It's around introducing protocols for the administration of an agency. One will need to always be training new entrants in how those mechanisms, how those protocols and practices work. But one can't just train without making sure there's a robust system to start with. One worries that sometimes we're going and training on concepts without making sure that the basic systems are in place to support the training that we, so that the training that is provided can be taken up and actually used, and capacity created rather than training courses attended. Let me stop there, and I'll leave space for my colleagues to add in on the areas that I've left out or covered in completely.
I think we sort of, because I sort of revenue sharing, the issue was on components. Maybe you can talk on components just quickly. Is that the component?
Okay. I think most of the questions on chapter one especially has been answered. But just the question on whether that the review was a continuation of the 2004 review, definitely yes. Just to give a background what happened, then in 2004 the social security function was shifted from provinces to national agency SASA, and at that point that money for payments of social grants was part of provincial function. So when that money went out of the equitable share, provinces like Limpopo and Eastern Cape lost heavily because they've got quite a chunk of social security, social grants beneficiaries. So at that point they complained that the equitable share was now losing its redistributive role and it's now more biased to urban provinces like Gauteng and Western Cape, and hence this necessitated this review. And when we conducted our initial assessment with the provinces, we found that they were even complaining about the social biasness of the formula, and they were complaining that they don't have enough discretion to spend on other things outside of your typical social functions like education and health. And hence, one of the recommendations we made was about incentivize provinces to raise more revenue. And I think this question has been answered. What I can just add there is that what we found was that most provinces do not really optimize revenue collection, especially on hospital fees and there was at some point even a proposal by the National Health Department that the health fees should be scrapped, and for us we see it as it's actually a constraint on provincial discretion as such. And the other issue obviously it's the surcharge on provincial on personal income taxes that the constitution allows provinces to, but there are certain administrative burdens, which obviously don't allow provinces to use that. Hence, we are saying that provinces should be incentivized to borrow. The time frames. Well, as far as the time frames is concerned, we have envisaged that this year in July, yes, last month was supposed to be the final leg of this project, and we at this point we are preparing to report to the Budget Council, which will be held in the next few weeks. But what obviously happens during the course of the work was that there are these developments, especially on national health insurances, which actually requires that there should be further work in addition to the recommendations that were. So there will be an additional leg on the review, which will be then be looking at how then do we take into account the developments on national health insurances and make sure that we make proposals that are in line with some of those proposals. Thank you.
Chair, just one or two comments here right now. Yep.
Thanks, Chair. There was a question around the impact of social grants on poverty and instances where the FFC seemed to be contradicting itself. Just to clarify this issue, we are acknowledging that social grants play an important role in reducing poverty. But we are also raising an issue of anecdotal evidence that social grants create perverse incentives, such that people who are beneficiaries but also suffering from HIV AIDS forgo treatment, because if you take treatment, your immune system improves. And based on your CD4 count, you tend to be cut out of the social security system. So the report is saying that there's an anecdotal evidence that people forgo that treatment so that they benefit. And also there are instances where in rural areas people would like to, you know, depend on pension from, you know, old age pension, instead of looking for jobs. So that is an anecdotal evidence that the report is saying that in as much as they are social grants are good, but you know there is this unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And the commission therefore makes a recommendation that instead of we need to tie, you know, social grants to welfare programs like what they are doing in India, by expanding public works, that instead of giving people, you know, so-called free money, but if people work through EPWP, it will be better for the country in terms of managing the economic effects of social grants. There were two questions raised around roads, whether the role of dedicated and so-called independent institutions play a role in not the delivery of roads. I think in our view, they do play a role, but there is a broader issue also around accountability and oversight, because money is being made available, but whether it's spent on roads, that's another issue that we still have to answer. And I think there is a space for institutions like the FFC, but also Parliament, you know, in terms of how do we coin accountability, making sure that we know exactly how many roads are going to be delivered upfront, so that then when we evaluate at the end, you know, there is a base to evaluate. But currently that system seems to be lacking, and, you know, it becomes a problem then to make a partial judgment or impartial judgment on whether we are delivering as a country or not. There was a question on, you know, the economic impact of tolling and people in the N2 refusing that. The Commission is making a recommendation that
there must be a cost-benefit analysis done. You know, there are roads whereby you can, you know, put your toll gates and raise revenue. I mean, it's a one is a public choice decision, but also, you know, in an open economy, your taxes and subsidies are symmetrical. So if you look at Mpumalanga, for example, where trucks are using roads by transporting coal to most power plants. Now, what is the option then to finance those roads? Do we put public funds to maintain those roads, or do we put tolling, you know, so that those industry participants pay for the usage of public roads? So it's a decision that we need to take as a country. And tolling, in my view, alternative transport system, the issue of Transnet playing a role. I mean, if you look at the rail economics, they will tell you that for long distance transport, rail is an effective way, you know, as compared to roads, because of economies of scale and the luggage that can carry. So, but it requires planning. It requires an institutional engagement around these issues of transportation. And currently, you know, it seems like we are looking at what roads are doing, and somebody is doing roads planning. But we need to relook at that from yeah, as government. Yeah.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Doctor. Follow up. Second round. Let me make the list. All the hands are going up. Sheila. Please. Mahoro. Nguni. Yeah. Mr. Harris. Mashile.
Yeah, Jefferson, it's not necessarily a follow-up. I'm sure maybe it's a reminder that I actually just requested information pertaining to the life of the FFC. When was it constituted, and when its life is going to come to an end, that we will have to start thinking about seeing it being reconstituted, and also is in terms of the number of members. As I tried to raise that in the slide, I think I came across 9 members, but when I looked into my old constitution, it was talking about other 9 over and above the 9 that comes from the president and the provinces and SALCA or something like that. And then there is another under D that says other 9, which almost account to about 18. Is that the reality? Is that it is under constituted, or what has happened? I did not get clarity. I just need that particular clarity. And yeah. I think that's what I just wanted to be briefed. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I hope that Dr. Sitai didn't imply that his commission is starved of funds at the moment, and that it was a hypothetical suggestion that may be aware of restricting the operations of the Commission, and perhaps he can just set my mind at rest on that one. Now, you know, we've had some people talk about the need for research and the reasons for not being able to comment on the National Health Insurance Scheme. Nevertheless, we have a lot of others saying, you know, it's anecdotal, and that, you know, that kind of research, to my mind, isn't really sufficient to then use for making recommendations. And in particular, I want to refer you to the social grants that we've discussed at some length, but,
No, there's a statement here, other effects include impact on teenage fertility. Now, I have no idea what that means. I mean, if you're talking about teenage pregnancy, then say it's pregnancy, but I don't know what you mean by fertility. And so, we must be careful, I think, of making recommendations based on anecdotal evidence. Mr. Chairman, the question of additional funding is made through a number of cases, except towards the end, where it wasn't, and management. And an example of this, indeed, is the MNBT Ladysmith Municipality in KwaZulu-Natal, which sits with some 50 million rand in the bank account, bearing virtually no interest, which is housing money, which has been sitting there for years. And there's just not a managerial capacity or political will to spend that money on housing. And so I think that's absolutely right, that there is not necessary just a question of throwing money at it. In fact, it's fairly trite to say, you need more funds. I think I'd all like to spend more money on all sorts of things. But again, where does the money come from? And is the money perhaps not already sitting there in bank accounts? And I think that the Commission needs to look at that if it has the resources and the capacity to do that, which it has limited. In terms of the hospital, there's a recommendation that the independence of hospital management be increased. And I think that that's an excellent recommendation. However, had I visited the provincial hospital in Newcastle last week, where the management of that hospital is desperate to make that hospital work. They've been designated as a mother and child hospital. Now, this is where central planning really has an incredibly myopic view, or a broad view, which doesn't look at the circumstances. Newcastle Hospital, provincial hospital, is in the middle of town, and then there's a Mater Dei hospital further out of town, which provides different services. And so people who are hurt in a medical accident go to the closest hospital. And the doctors there are going to say, well, you've got a broken jaw. They can't treat you. It's not our mandate. You must go to King Edward in Durban or Addington or one of the Durban hospitals, I think, handles that. So what happens is they actually do the thing. They have an unfunded mandate. And so they're dealing with a whole lot of unfunded mandates simply because central planning has said, you're simply a mother and child, therefore your budget is mother and child. The management of the hospital say, but we can't run that hospital like that. And I have huge sympathy for the management of that hospital. They go out on a limb to provide the service, even while the funding is non-existent for that particular mandate. And so if that recommendation is to give more authority to that management to run a hospital, then the centralized planning or whatever provincial planning cannot then hamstring them by giving them a limited mandate. In other words, they're not rather authorized to buy their surgical gloves for the mother and child aspect of their mandate. But then the rest of them, the work that they have to do to provide the service is not mandated. So there's a link here between giving them authority and giving them authority for what? And I think that's crucial. They have a brand new child ward, cost millions, it's locked up. Because they don't have funds for furniture, they don't have funds for staff, they don't have funds for medication. My wife has a goddaughter who is an intern in a granite hospital in a trauma unit. She's out there right now as we speak trying to raise funds to get the lights in the theater working, to get money to buy instruments so that they can do operations on trauma patients. So, management is an excellent way of dealing with it, but I think it's a far bigger, broader problem in the health, in public hospitals, provincial hospitals.
I'm sorry, Chair. I just wanted to get where the hospital that Honourable is referring to. Which hospital is that?
Mr. Chairman, it's the Newcastle Provincial Hospital.
The
one constituency, Mr.
Yeah. You mentioned the municipality. I didn't get the name.
Newcastle? Or, Mbambiki, in Mbambiki Ladysmith, Mr. Chairman, most of you probably know it as Ladysmith, but it's in Mbambiki, that's our name for our area. And in fact, it's the official name of the municipality as well. Mr. Chairman, may I continue? Thank you. Mr. Chairman, somewhat of a loss is what's meant on page 20 by unfairly. I need a bit of an explanation about what is meant by unfair. And that's referring, I think, to, if I remember correctly, in my memory like yours, we're both over 50, somewhat short. In terms of qualifying income bands, is what is meant by unfairly? Because, I mean, that's an interesting comment. And then on page 21... I need a little bit of help with the question of formulating price. Is that on that page? Perhaps I've got the wrong page. Formulating pricing and cost recovery. Bottom 22, page 22 it is. Mr. Chairman, I do, as you heard, speak Zulu, and I do speak English, and I speak a spattering of German and not very good Afrikaans. A lot of what I read here is kind of code language. I wish it would be simplified into very simple English so that I can understand what I'm reading. Zulu, I'm illiterate, Mr. Chairman. Please don't give it to me in Zulu. I'll speak with it. I can't read it. So, if I could get some explanation as to what exactly that is about. And then it was interesting, the comment on leakage was made when discussing water, and I thought that was very appropriate. Leakage, the concept applies on all sorts of things, but just an aside, I thought it was very appropriate. And also the question of behavior change. Mr. Chairman, behavior change is something that I feel very strongly about, and I'm really pleased that the Commission is recommending that a lot more emphasis be put on that. I spent a day 2 weeks ago, was 2 weeks ago I think, digging trenches for a house for a very destitute family. That's not the issue. But the issue that arose was that there were 7 children in this family under the age of 10. And the thing that struck me was there are 3 adults in this family. Is that they do not have a lavatory of any sort. And when the children wanted to urinate, they simply urinate where they were standing. And it's not the children's fault. And it's probably not the adult's fault. It's our fault. Because we're not putting any emphasis on that kind of behavioral change. And obviously it wasn't appropriate for me to start a hygiene lesson at that point. But I really do believe that the Commission has hit the nail on the head on this one. Is that the facilities are clearly important, but the behavioral change is probably more important. And one can actually take a shovel and dig a hole rather than simply do it where you choose to do it, Mr. Chairman. And then I would disagree about the question of water resources being not as important as electricity. There are all sorts of ways of generating new electricity, and a lot of people hate the idea of nuclear and so on. But it's kind of you can add to the pool of electricity. Water is pretty much finite, as I understand it. I'm not an engineer of any sort, and so yes, perhaps the crisis isn't upon us as we speak, although I think sometimes it is in some areas. But it's something we really have to address with a little bit more urgency, I believe, than we do now. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time.
When we dealt with the Department of Agriculture, the Committee on Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, I sensitized the Minister, Tina Juma-Patterson, who was present. There's a document in the department regarding bulk water supply for the next 30 years, and it's compiled for every province. It is available. And I want to ask the members to go into to get hold of that document, because it's there, it's printed. It gives you an insight what is foreseen in the future in terms of water supply to your specific province. In my province in Northern Cape, we've got a serious problem with water. We've got two rivers, main rivers, running through the province, the Orange River and the Vaal River. But 4 days in December in Port Norris, Richtersveld Municipality, for 4 days we haven't got water, but 85 kilometers north of us, the Orange River is running into the Atlantic Ocean. The same is happening at Buckley West. It's a question of, are we doing our oversight? Are we taking the issues where it's supposed to be addressed? Are we following up those issues? Are we coming back with the answers to those communities? We're going into a provincial week, the 7th to the 11th of September, the National Council of Provinces. That's an excellent week to take or to go and visit again. Bring the issues to the specific select committee or to the NA. Take it up with the cabinet minister. Take it up with the municipality. Take it up with the NEC. Take the issue forward and come up with a solution. One of the solutions in the Northern Cape, on the western side of the province, is to build a dam at Fjordsdrift. It's going to take 7 years. It's a process. In partnership with Namibia. That will solve the issue of water in Namakwa, down to Fraserburg in the south, where it borders on the Western Cape. It's part of the solution. So we must also come up with solutions. Honorable Mokgoro, Ben Nguni, Mr. Harris, will you hand up? Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just one question. I thought I'll pick it up in one of the presentations by the FFC, but I failed to do that. Maybe I didn't hear, but I would like clarification. I want to know from the FFC what criteria they use in recommending allocation to various provinces. Because in my view, the needs of provinces are not the same and they can never ever be the same. So therefore, one would like to know, what are the specific criteria that they FFC is using in making this allocation? There are provinces that are really suffering from, from development. For instance, my province is suffering. And I would like one day, as the doctor has promised that they will come one day here, and had a debate, maybe one can have a an opportunity to put across and actually substantiate your point in trying to show that some provinces are really disadvantaged in terms of development, in terms of funding, in terms of migration as well. And these are all factors that can be shown as to how they come about. So my point is, what criteria is the FFC using in recommending allocation? Recommending us, I'm still saying. Thank you.
Well, Guni?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a follow-up on the recommendation by AFC that they would like to incentivize, or the recommendation that provinces must be incentivized to borrow. I do understand the explanation that perhaps they'll be more disciplined and responsible when they put money borrowed, because the lender will be a bit stricter on the outcomes. But my fear is that actually you effectively increase the burden, the debt burden to the national government or to the state, because more provinces, since we pass the act for them to be able to take to generate their own revenue. No province has done so except with the Cape on the petrol levy, as far as I know. Now, if you say you incentivize the provinces to borrow, how are they going to pay back, as you correctly said, pay back the money, other than that you wait for the state, national government should then again pay them out of which you when you come to your home, division of revenue with the top slicing will be increases and less services will be provided to other local governments and provincial governments. It has no concern, Chair, how are they going to repay the debt if they will incentivize them to borrow. My second question is just a follow-up on what Honorable Harris asked. We say FFC seems to be encouraging that the more expenditure, whereas the economic turn down is the opposite. We've so far the SARS and this is that there will be 60 billion rand loss due to economic activity or due to economic downturn, and yet FFC says we must spend more. How to reconcile the two? It's just a question that was asked by the Minister here.
Sorry.
That's exactly one of the things I was going to ask. Thanks for bringing it up again. Just something that wasn't covered in my first set of questions, this idea that the FFC has a very low-key role in the budget process or a non-existent role. I'd just like an explanation on how that could be possible and what they plan to do about it.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just realized that I may not have an opportunity to ask these questions. That's why I just wanted to bring them in now before I lose the opportunity. I actually just wanted to ask whether from the FFC's position, whether there are any pieces of legislation that actually prohibits them to actually discharge their services that they would wish Parliament to unblock, and also whether in the Enabling Act of the FFC, whether there are any sections that they feel that those sections need review for them to efficiently discharge their mandate. Of course, already they have indicated, I think, whether it was consciously or unconsciously, the issues of receiving budget from Treasury, and whereas they have to actually advise Treasury and or government, you know, that that relationship actually is contradictory. Probably that's why we had that explanation that talks to the relationship that we are talking to Treasury every time. Probably one of the reasons is to make sure that when times comes to get money, then they don't withhold the money as well, you see. So if there are any sections of that act that give establishment of the FFC that needs to be reviewed, if they are there, then if we can... And then the other third question, Chair, is the FFC known across the country, across all the nine provinces? Is it known? And have you met the new provincial executive councils that are now in place since May? If not, how do they know that you exist, and how do they know that you can be of service to them? And are they not currently functioning as if FFC doesn't exist? Because they are new councils, and they are taking political decisions or macro economic decisions as we're speaking now, which may not be in line with what we have advised, you know, a few years back or so. That's what I just wanted to know. And also those that are dealing with infrastructure. There has been a wholesale accreditation of municipalities as water services authorities. And now, in view of these skills, lack of skills and whatever, and what is the impact of that? Because the Water Services Authority, that's a huge authority that is being given to an institution, and that it must manage the, you know, it's a water supply and the sustainability of the water supply and managing the demand. And but now many municipalities, because they wanted power and whatever, but then they demanded, or it was a carte blanche accreditation. What is the impact of that? Is it possible that FSC maybe can have a look at that and do the research, whether it has contributed in this unsustainable potable water supply to our people? And the other thing which is very crucial to me, Chair, not necessarily to get an answer today, is whether, you know, it's in the near future we can get assistance in the form of a list of all the funding windows of government, you know, is for funding for service deliveries. You know, it's in one department you may find that, you know, they've got funds to fund to X, Y, Z, and some of those funding windows as local municipalities or as ordinary members, we don't know, because they are embedded in certain legislations that we don't deal with. And if it is possible just to get that one page or two page at least, to say, here, you know, you've got this particular fund that funds X, you've got this in this act that funds X, I think maybe it may assist us, especially when we go back to the provinces, to actually assist our local municipalities, you know, where they can source these funds. Thanks, Chair.
Doctor, you can respond.
Chair, sorry.
Maybe. I noted your the honourable member.
Have you noted my hand, sir?
I see you now, yes, sir.
Oh,
I apologize for earlier on. No, just one question. Equalization vis-a-vis infrastructure backlogs. I've got a serious problem. I've been raising this thing, you know, for many years with the FSC. The issue of the backlogs, particularly in provinces like Eastern Cape, why I would have expected that by this time we have considered funding infrastructure backlogs seriously as a nation. Otherwise, provinces will never be equal in terms of development. I see you talking about expansion of existing infrastructure. So, but the issue of backlogs infrastructure, because the infrastructure which does not even exist in some areas. So I'm not convinced that as a nation we are focusing on infrastructure. The rural development is supposed to focus in that area. I don't know whether Treasury can respond to that at what stage. I don't know. But FSC, are you satisfied that as a country we are funding infrastructure development, backlogs in particular? So I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond, and after that I'll give Treasury also an opportunity to make their input, and then we will break for lunch.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Maybe Mr. Mashile's earlier question then on the life of FSC. Commissioner, if I'm correct, it started immediately 1994-95, I think, if my time is right, you know, around that time, as a permanent institution. So it's in the constitution as a permanent institution. To close it, to just take years, you know, a lot of work, you know, among which six provinces must also be consulted out of the nine to say, you know, let's close FSC. Now, in terms of the commissioners, there are nine commissioners. They were reduced from that huge number because it was felt that, you know, it was unmanageable. So they were reduced to nine, and then through a constitutional amendment, right? Yeah. And then there are two full-time, the chair and the deputy chair. In terms of the constitution, they're both, let me just say, they're both full-time. But then the chair is the accounting officer of the FFC. No, only say that. You honorable member. Yeah. So, that's what it is. And then, of course, you know, we make recommendations and so forth. On, but
Oh, no, no, oh, I'm sorry. No, the other seven are part-time.
And for five?
The terms of a five, the act are for anything up to a five-year term that is renewable. And the act specifies the appointment procedures for the four national appointees, including the two full-time appointees, three provincial. Yeah, two provincial and two. I think it's actually three provincial and two local. Yeah, and the act specifies the procedures for the provinces reaching consensus, and for SOLGA nominating its representatives to the commission to make the nine.
And then recently I think we just or the process is kicked off by the Treasury, basically. For the selection of the commissioners, because that is the executing agency, and then the president must sign. So the appointment is done by the president, so to speak. You know, on the recommendation of the Treasury, that will have consulted with provincial and local governments before deciding. I mean, passing the names on to the president. And on the question of funding, yes, we are on a really very limited budget. If I were to mention it, it's really very limited. You know, very limited. It's not a secret. When we bring our annual report, it will all be there, right? But it does also then talk on the question of are we known in the provinces? We have a stakeholder function in the FFC that we have been, you know, we are actually rolling it out, because before it wasn't that big, precisely because it's costly to go to the provinces. But since I've been in, we have been going to some provinces. We have not gone to all of them to explain ourselves as to who we are. And in some provinces, we are quite surprised that people have always been polite, you know, allowed us to make our recommendations or known inside the provincial legislatures. But when we have gone one-on-one to speakers in some of the provinces, we're surprised to find that they thought we were an arm of the executive, you know, and that they were just polite seeing us and so forth. But then we've had to explain that we are there for them and they are there for us. You know, so that has not been a problem at all when we have explained ourselves. The Chapter 9 review by Professor Kada Asman, he actually thought we were really understaffed. He thought that we really should have representatives in provinces at the commission level, people who should be there talking to provinces and so on, you know. But understand those recommendations are still standing. Not much has happened to them. I think it's the work for the new parliament now to look through those recommendations, and then we then can get new mandates as to what to do going forward, especially on the operational matters. I think, I will then pass on to my colleagues. I think, you want to pick it up from,
best. Other than just to add, in terms of, clearly, I think resources are a challenge for any agency in the public sector, and I think that, we're looking very hard as a commission at how we can improve our effectiveness within our current resource envelope, and we do think there are opportunities to get better at what we do, and so we're fairly aggressively pursuing those. But obviously, you know, there will be a ceiling hit at some point in terms of what we can extract from every rand, and we are getting there are obviously major projects we have to drop as a result that we would like to take forward. The question on I'd just like to assure the honourable member on the question of anecdotal evidence. Without throwing back the anecdotal evidence that he shared, and that was so interesting, absolutely. I think that in presentations, as you noted, we need to get better at expressing ourselves in clearer language. So we've actually encouraged our researchers to bring in anecdote, bring in real world examples. You will find in the actual detailed technical reports, there's no anecdotal evidence. And we do hold ourselves to, I think, a very high and appropriate standard in that respect. But as we try and explore better ways of communicating, we do have anecdotal evidence, because I think that we try and be clear on where it is anecdotal, just to give a real world contact to things. And I think we do take your criticism that some of the languages that we tend to use in the Commission can be entirely impenetrable. And we do apologize for that, and it's an ongoing challenge for ourselves to make it cleaner, and expressed better. So that is one of the areas that we do work on as the Commission, but it's obviously a process. You did note this question of the rental bans and the question of a lack of fairness in the rental bans. What that really talks to is two factors. Is when you have a rental band an income band of any sort that essentially determines access to a particular benefit, you get a kind of cliff edge effect. Is the one thing is that if I just happen to earn 3,501 rand a month, I'm suddenly not eligible. But that is manifestly unfair, because that 1 rand is so little of a difference to my ability to have a vastly different quality of life. So that's the one effect that you get from bans. The second effect that you get from an income banding system is that, which tax brackets have to deal with as well, is this question of creep. Which is where where inflation may reduce the value of the band without people's life circumstances changing significantly. So you would not want to target them, but they've shifted in the band because of the effects of inflation on salaries and the value of money. So there are those two issues that do lead to unfairness, a kind of manifest unfairness in application of bans, and I think the Commission is saying, let's pay a lot to this issue, because these bans were introduced a good number of years ago, and we need to review and understand the extent to which that system is now leading to errors of exclusion that would be inappropriate or undesirable, and in some cases unfair as well. The question on water, I think both a number of people raised. I don't want you to go away with the impression that the Commission doesn't think that there are very significant water challenges facing the country. It's just the point is that these are not generation challenges in the same extent that the electricity crisis was triggered by failures on the generation side. Most members will probably know that South Africa is a very water scarce country. We are not blessed with an inordinate amount of the resource, like for example Bangladesh, which quite frankly sometimes feels it has too much of it. We're quite in the other boat. Yet we have a history, and I think the chairman referred to it of an ongoing capacity for exceptionally good management of a limited resource at the resource end, at dams and the bulk supply end. The challenge facing water services, particularly for households in South Africa, is the challenge of water quality. And water quality can be degraded both by biological factors, contamination of sewage, sewerage and so forth, as well as by chemical factors from mining and so forth. So I think a lot of the evidence is suggesting that there is a there's a water quality issue is the real issue that we need to rise to, and that's counterintuitive once one realizes when one comes from the perspective that we're a water scarce country in the first place. So the challenges are just slightly different to the electricity industry. It's not to say that they are less important in any way. I will leave my colleagues to explain to Mr. Mukhoro around the criteria in the equitable share. The just on the question of borrowing, that provinces shouldn't borrow. I mean, I think we've adopted probably appropriately in the past a fairly conservative framework in that regard, saying yes, they shouldn't borrow. But provinces may increasingly want to, for example, time shift the allocation of the availability of resources to undertake a large capital project. And there's no reason that they should necessarily be constrained from doing that, provided that it's a sensible investment. So what I mean by time shifting is just that borrowing allows you to invest today for something that you will use over the next 20 years. We're talking about borrowing in the context, long-term borrowing for the acquisition of assets. To try and borrow that asset over the 20-year lifespan with the resources that you have available every year is just simply not possible. So by borrowing, you can pool assets now and pay them off as you use it over their lifespan. So it's a fairly efficient, that is why it is regarded as a very efficient mechanism of financing infrastructure investment. And there's no reason, I think, that provinces shouldn't borrow, but I think one needs to be very conscious of the trade-offs. They're going to be buying money at a higher price than national government can buy money. But then there may be a set of benefits in terms of the utilization, the effectiveness through which they utilize that money, and their ability to invest in, to time shift the resources and invest in infrastructure today that will support growth, poverty reduction over a much longer time span. So I don't think one needs to be there's no ideology on the question of borrowing. It's a question of is it the appropriate instrument in a particular circumstance? And I think that the Act recognizes that it may be an appropriate instrument, and the Commission is saying, well, clearly it may be an appropriate instrument in some circumstances. Let's encourage provinces to use it in those instances where it is an appropriate instrument, and the trade-off comes out appropriately. What makes the conscious trade-off between the increased cost of the debt and the benefits associated with the expenditures, that you can demonstrate that it is the appropriate instrument to use in that case. The question of why spend more when revenue is down? I would hate for the recommendations to be seen purely as saying spend more. I think the commission would take the perspective that it's predominantly saying spend more wisely, and that there are things that we can do to improve the effectiveness of every rand being spent. Why spend more when revenue is declining? I can probably leave our technical specialists to talk about counter-cyclical spending and Keynesian economics, but it's not unusual to do that in the midst of a downturn, to keep domestic demand up and speed up an economic recovery. So that's not unusual, and I think government is already pursuing a counter-cyclical strategy in that regard. Why a low key role in the budget process for the FFC? Mr. Harris had asked that question again. In fact, we didn't get around to it in the first round. I think I will start with I'll focus on the introspection side. I think that there is more that the Commission can do to make its views more clearly understood and known in terms of engaging the fora to which it has access, the Budget Council, the Budget Forum, engaging those fora more proactively than it has in the past, I think we can do more in engaging those forums. I think that in the past also the budget process has been a fairly restricted process that was quite heavily controlled by the executive. Now the legislature through the Money Bills Amendment Act has a far greater role, and the Commission has already indicated that it has a role in terms of both that Act and its broader mandate to, I think, advise Parliament on budget choices, and is very willing, as indicated, is very willing to assist as Parliament builds the budget management capacity internally over time. So I think it's partially been a function of circumstance in that we haven't had a very open budget framework in the past. We now do have one, and I think that will change, and the Commission may be able to play a higher profile role if you want. And second, I think we need to get better at pursuing what we would regard as key expenditure outcomes and impacts over time that we think are important. However, that being said, I don't think the Commission is established to be high profile. That is the role of the kind of elected representatives of the people. It is the role of the executive, and so forth. So the Commission is a committee of experts that is intended to advise. And sometimes the best advice is the soft advice. It's the quietest advice. So it's not that the Commission has any particular desire to build a large profile for itself, because that's not always the most effective way to fulfill our duties and responsibilities. So I think there's a question of strategy and tactics both in that answer. On the question of blocking legislation, I've not come across any legislation that I've regarded as specifically blocking to the mandate of the Commission. So I'd have to answer not particularly there. I mean, we come across legislation that we think is flawed for all number of reasons, but that's our role, is to comment on legislation. But the legislation itself doesn't block the work of the Commission. There was a question on the water services authorities and municipalities having the capacity. Very detailed but important question. I hesitate to try and answer it now, in fact, because I think that there's that's quite a debate that you're opening up there. So if you don't mind, I'll back off from that one for the moment, but be happy to take it up with you outside of this question, outside of this session. On the question of funding windows and where resources are so that information can be made available, I would say absolutely, I think that the Commission would be more than happy to assist in putting together that one-page picture, and that, in fact, you know, just informally we can undertake to do so. I think Dr. Sitak, that most of that information is in fact captured in the schedules to the Division of Revenue Act, which provide individual grant allocations as well as the design of what these grant programs are, what they're there for individual municipalities and individual provinces over 3 years. So there's quite a lot of information on the exact amounts of money that are intended to be allocated and the conditions under which they're going to be allocated. But it's the Division of Revenue Act, and particularly the schedules in terms of the Act, that are particularly important in that regard. The Treasury's budget review does cover the programs, but the schedules to the Act are that kind of one pager that I think you're looking for. Unfortunately, it's more than one page, because of just the sheer number of municipalities. But we'd be more than happy on a policy level. What I would strongly encourage your committee to look at is the extent to which programs that are transferring resources to provinces or municipalities are covered by the Division of Revenue Act. They intend that the Act intends to include those allocations to avoid these kind of big pots of money that can just go wherever a department thinks they should go, but so that they are fairly and clearly and coherently distributed between municipalities in terms of the objectives of a program. So it's not just a big pot of flush money. So if the committee does become aware of these programs, it's, you know, that there's just kind of fat sitting on departments' budgets, that they are not distributing it, and that they do intend to distribute it to a province or a municipality, it should, by law, be covered. It should be governed by the processes outlined in the Division of Revenue Act to give fairness, predictability, transparency and allocation, a basic modicum of robustness in the design of the transfer program, and so forth. So I think that the committee, you have every right to ask that question, and the fact that you haven't got an answer yet is a problem, but it's something that the committee will need to monitor going forward and demand that all departments do reveal the resources that are being transferred in that manner.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Question of from Honourable Member Mokhoro. Rakabe Edi, can you answer that one, please?
Okay. The question on how funds are allocated between provinces. The first chapter on our submission focuses specifically on the provincial equitable share formula. How that formula works is that it comprises of six components, which is the education component, health component, the basic component, poverty, economic activity component, and the institutional component. The indicators used in the education component, which is your number of school-going children, and a province will get more money if it's got a high proportion of school-going children of the total national school-going children. In the health component, we use the number of people with medical aid and the number of people without medical aid. Basic component is the population. Poverty is the number of people who are poor in a province. Economic activity, the GDP, the contribution to GDP by province, and the ethnic component, it's shared equally by all the provinces. And in total, it takes about 5% of the total equitable share. The current review, one of the things that we were looking at was the backlogs, and at certain point in time, the equitable share had a backlog component, but it was since taken out when the provincial infrastructure grant and the provincial infrastructure grant was introduced. It was felt that backlogs will be appropriately funded through the provincial infrastructure grant. But it has since came again that maybe that was not such a good decision, and hence the current review was also taking into consideration the issues of backlog. Every year, the formula is updated with data from Statistics South Africa, and that data takes into account migration. If people move from one particular province to another province, obviously it's a minus on the other provinces, but it's a gain on the other province, which is also an issue that we're looking at. And what we found was that provinces like your Eastern Cape and Limpopo, and to a lesser extent KZN, were mostly affected by migration. So what we didn't want to do was to use the equitable share to resolve all the problems affecting. So we wanted to make sure that the equitable share remained focused as a transfer mechanism, which does not necessarily have to deal with all to overload it with different objectives. So we thought, if the migration is an issue, then there should be another funding mechanism that should be dealt with outside the equitable share to deal with the issues of migration as well as the backlog. But we haven't really made any recommendation on those yet. As I said earlier, that the review will be continuing in light of what is currently happening, and obviously taking into account the migration issues and the block.
Yeah, can you see? So,
just to clarify the issue of the FFC recommending an increase in government expenditure during the time of recession. I mean, this slide, the last bullet point, we are making a recommendation that, I mean, there is, during recession, government has a role to play in order to bring the economy to an equilibrium in a way. And if you can target these areas and you run a 10% increase in the budget based on that, if you increase not by this budget but focus on these infrastructure sectors, I think they will assist the country to increase its productivity levels and also, you know, employ you know, people. So this is an area that we think, you know, government can play a role, and I mean, analysts have already, you know, are saying that South Africa is not hardest hit by the economic recession globally because of its focus spending on infrastructure. And as the FFC is saying that if we can, you know, focus on infrastructure, we'll be better off.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, members, for your questions. This was an intensive session since we started. We will break for lunch now. After lunch, we will give Treasury an opportunity to make their input on what the discussion was this morning.